Welcome to the Mortal Realms. Grab your hammer so we can clear a path through the chaos and forge our own narratives in the Age of Sigmar. Your allies through the Realm Gate this episode are...
I'm Davey, the Never Chosen.
This is Mal, a Rider of the Storm.
And I'm Eric.
What up, liches? The Mortal Realms is a podcast focused on the Age of Sigmar, a new fantasy battle game of Games Workshop. Our podcast is about maximizing the fun that we and anyone listening can have playing Age of Sigmar. We'll be discussing stories and fluff, hobby, gameplay and tactics, news in the community, as well as being a resource for new players. If you have a gaming event coming up, let us know. We want to be a support for anyone else who contributes to the AOS community. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the Age of Sigmar starter set and the stories and models associated with that release. In the story phase, we're going to be discussing the book, Gates of Azir, as this was the first story that came out for Age of Sigmar. In the hero phase, we're going to walk through the starter box content itself, and in the hobby phase, we'll discuss our personal experience assembling and painting the models. In the campaign phase, we're going to walk through the battle plans and the war scrolls, looking at the rules. We want to look at the battle plans as they relate back to the story, and we want to look for and identify some of those synchronicities that you'd expect to find in each of these armies. But first, let's start with the community phase. The community phase. In the community phase, we talk about the news and events that are significant to the AOS community. Given that our podcast is new in the community, we wanted to do an unboxing of the three of us, who we are, how we game to be podcast eternals in the Age of Sigmar. So, Davey, as our veteran player, why don't you start us off? Let's all answer these two questions. What's your history in the hobby, and why are you playing Age of Sigmar?
So I got started back, I was living in Dublin, Ireland back in the 90s with my family, and picked up a game called Space Crusade and discovered with my friends that actually involved you could, it was the background of a bigger game, Warhammer 40,000. So got started in the 40K Rogue Trader days, and that's where I stayed for quite a while till third, maybe fourth edition, went on a bit of a hobby hiatus. And when I came back, I thought I'd check out fantasy. It was always one of those, you'd be flipping through White Dwarf and it seemed cool. So jumped into that, worked with dwarves, and in the true slow and plodding nature of dwarves, took me like 10 years to put together a 2,000 point army. So it was good times. But we got switched over to Chaos. I was looking for something that could cast magic and move fast, so I started the Slaanesh. And now that Age of Sigmar has arrived, I am really excited. I've been playing games here with Erica. We're both parents here, and so our schedules have matched up pretty well as far as playing those games after the little ones are asleep. And so we've kind of connected on the idea of how to play a game where you're trying to tell a story and getting excited about some of the bigger aspects. I do have lots of GT experience, or maybe not lots relative to some, but I've played in 5 or 6 down in Texas back in 2011, 2012. That was kind of my big competitive moment, and which meant that I was usually ending up middle of the pack, so competitive in quotes. But yeah, Age of Sigmar is just capturing the spirit for me right now as far as being able to tell stories with the models that I've put together, and I've got a lot of projects I'm excited about. That's what's got me going here. Mal, what's your take on it over there? How do you answer that question? Why are you playing Age of Sigmar, and how'd you get started?
Okay, so it's a similar starting point in the hobby. You know, again, back in the early 90s, picked up HeroQuest in my case. Same, you know, group of buddies were all playing, super excited about kind of this fantasy setting. But at the same time, we started to play a game called Epic 40,000, early Rogue Trader stuff. So I think it was for my gaming group and I, we got into the sci-fi stuff way more than the fantasy. It just gripped us. So we're playing 40K, playing Epic. It was back in those days where we were maybe 10, 11, 12 years old, and you collect a whole bunch of models, and they were hardly ever painted. I remember some of us had them, you know, stuck together with two-part epoxy. It was just horrible, horrible looking hobby stuff. And we would spend, you know, weekends where we'd line up. Like the scenario would be, right, okay, line up. Everyone gets their models. We'll split.
I think people can really identify with that. You're talking about that. It's bringing back all these memories of, you know, in the Rogue Trader days and in those age of like 12 and 13 years old, the amount we talked about games versus the amount we actually played games was just totally out of proportion. You know, just like, oh man, I'm gonna launch a missile that drops vortex grenade mines all over your army. You know, just so much talking about it. This is really bringing back some memories. Keep lay it on me.
So we would line them up, and you'd maybe get through the first turn's worth of shooting before we had to like wrap it for the weekend. Yeah, when you talk about the missiles with vortex. I think my personal favorite was that I had this big missile that was going to shoot out biowire. Now this is you know, old school 40k centric, and the idea being that this, you know, huge mass of genetically modified thorns would just destroy the entire army, and I was obsessed with the idea that it was going to kill it. And without fail, that missile scattered off the board every single time. It's horrendous. And then like yourself, you know, took a hiatus around about, yeah, must have been the mid to late 90s, which coincided with you kind of teenage years and realizing that, oh, you know, this geeky stuff is bad. No, you know, we can't be seen to be doing this in public. So, you know, then when I was at university, I started to get back into it. And when Warhammer 40,000 third edition dropped, so third into fourth, that was when I started to get, you know, really back into it. And, you know, I've been kind of background noise in my life ever since. Been primarily a 40k player up until now, and then decided to get into 8th edition fantasy maybe 2.5 years ago, and had just started to put the finishing touches on a Lizardman army when Age of Sigmar dropped. So why did I decide to embrace Age of Sigmar wholeheartedly? I think just the fact that, well, you know, Games Workshop has been a part of my life for a very long time, and I have, without wanting to sound like a fanboy, which I inevitably will, they've done very little in terms of actual product that I haven't loved. So when I saw Age of Sigmar, I thought, you know, I'm going to embrace the positivity, give it a shot, and it turns out that it's a great time. It's a lot of fun. It is a very, very different game from fantasy, as we talked about last episode. I mean, it's actually also a very different game from 40k, which is my other great love. So, you know, I'm very happy to be playing it, and I get a very different experience from it. You know, and kind of evangelizing to my friends about it, it has been great. They're all on board. So, you know, it's more GW, therefore, you know, more fun. How about you, Eric?
Well, both of you have quite a bit more experience than I do. You're talking about your vortex grenade bomb dropper thingies. I got no clue. I got none. I played a little bit of D&D back in high school, and I only played maybe like 4 or 5 times, because like, how many times could you actually get together for like an all-night D&D game? But those are some of my like fondest memories from high school, because high school in general sucks. So a couple years ago, some years ago, I started my own business. It's gone really well, but that's all I was doing was business until I had my kids. My son was born a little over 3 years ago, and we just got to that point where like I had the family stuff, I had the work stuff, and it was a lot. And I needed to find a hobby. I needed to find something that I could dig into. So I got back into D&D. I grabbed a couple of my employees and forced them to let me DM some games, and they loved it. But then I was like, okay, I can't just hang out with my employees all the time. Ended up getting into Warhammer Fantasy in beginning of 2014. Not because I was like, oh, I like this game, it looks cool. I had not seen a single game played, but I saw the ogre box of just the bulls, and I was like, because I was initially looking for kind of like some bad guys for playing on the D&D table. So I was like, oh, I can get like a whole bunch of guys to swarm around this. So, but I picked up the ogre box. I loved those guys. I started putting them together, and then I was like, oh, maybe I should figure out how to play this game. I went back, bought some more ogres, bought the book, tried to read through that damn book. I could not, for the life of me, like figure out how to play the game by reading the book. So I started looking at YouTube videos and all that kind of stuff, and managed to get onto the our local Warhammer forums. Got down to the local game shop where I'd bought them. They were playing the games. Got out to a Monday night, played my first game, got stomped. And I was like, I love this. Stop me some more. When I dig into something, I dig into it pretty hard. I like focusing in on something and doing it really well and doing it, I don't have like four or five different games that I play really. I have the one. So I was focusing on ogres. I built my 2,000 points in probably like 2.5 months, painted and all that kind of stuff. Because I was spending like 4 hours a night after the kids went to bed, after the wife went to bed, I'd stay up until like 1 a.m. just hobbying the shit out of this stuff. That's our first bleep, I think. So I got into that. And then about the time the end time started and the Nagash model came out, I picked that guy up because that was the most epic model I had seen in the whole range. Like, it just, from a model standpoint, from a story standpoint, like I really didn't get into the Warhammer fluff prior to that. I'd read my book fluff, you know, maybe some things here or there, but I was just captured by that guy. And so that was the start of my undead army. And I really started painting that one up to really, I felt like a much higher standard than I did my ogres, converting everything, all that kind of stuff. And I found the list that I wanted to build sucked. it was an all skeleton. Listen, I didn't, again, not being a hardcore gamer, my list.
All skeleton all the time.
It's,
sounds
it's
awesome.
Terrible. So then, you know, the end times happened. We did some campaign stuff with our Monday night group, and Davey and I started doing some story driven stuff that was really cool. That kind of, we weren't making lists. We were saying, well, what would be cool to put together? We didn't get a lot of these kinds of things in, but we did this one game where Davey had a list of a group of dwarves that he felt would live in a human town. And that they were leaving the town because the captain there had made a deal.
Bars were all too high?
Well, they were offended that the captain of the town was going to form a bond with this vampire lord to help push back the demons. And they're like, no, we're out of here. And so the game was, so it was like, you had like two or three units and a thane in there. And then I had one necromancer on a horse who had to run out and summon anything it could, like not like everything. It could like low level stuff, but to try and stop them and or kill them or just keep them from getting off the board by turn 5 or turn 6.
I figured that would probably solve all of the the inter race relations in that town. Like, no, you can't leave because we're going to kill you.
Undead is a single race. You know, it embraces all. those were the types of games we were starting to get into. My second child came into this world. And so I took off another like month and a half of everything. And kind of when I came back out, I popped my head back up. This is what was dropping. I was getting so excited in the lead up to it. And, why do I like Age of Sigmar? I feel like it reflects exactly the direction that my gaming was going. It didn't put points on the table. It didn't care whether or not, my skeletons, in this game, when we've played it, they're pretty good. But if you're setting up a narrative game, if you're putting together a campaign of some sort, like you can put say, I want to play this type of model. And you just bend the environment, the scenario, whatever, to make them good. To make it worth it. What's gonna balance that out? Whatever it is, like, so we were already kind of putting that kind of in our own hands, saying, great point system and battle line stuff, GW, but we're gonna do our own thing with it. So this felt like a huge, like, no, they've been reading our minds. when I wasn't able to hobby as much, I was listening to a ton of podcasts, every podcast I can get, and traveling more with work. Tons of podcasts. And about that, when AOS came out, Age of Sigmar came out, a lot of podcasts just weren't quite sure. And so I wasn't quite getting the coverage that I was looking for. Not to anybody's fault, because you gotta put out what you feel comfortable putting out. There's a part of me that said, hey, I'd really like to hear more positive, constructive, and dive deep into Age of Sigmar. Segway, I had been talking to Davey at one point about doing a Dad Hammer podcast type of thing, because it's a different trying to get games in, all that kind of stuff when you got work and you got kids. It's just, and not everybody experiences it. So, Dave, do you remember, you and I were talking about that, but do you remember the first conversation we had about this, about doing this podcast?
Yeah. So it was Age of Sigmar. The rumors had finally started to coalesce and make be a little more clear about what was coming. And then the box set dropped and everyone was deciding whether, am I in or am I out? And, we were looking at it and we're like, I think I'm in. I think I'm excited about this and let's do it. And we'd already had that conversation about, trying to do a podcast about a different subject. So that seed was in the ground. And then Eric mentioned, I think I'm excited enough to do a podcast on this, and pitched it my way. I said, absolutely. Let's see if we can make it happen. So we kicked around some names. We're like, it would be cool names, Mortal Realms. Let's go see if that's available. And we said, oh, son of a gun, it's not. And,
well, coming from my business and marketing background, like when I have an idea for a website or a product or whatever, I go and snatch it up everywhere, find all the platforms and grab it. And some bastard had already taken Mortal Realms, the Twitter handle, taken, I think, not the... I was looking for a couple of things. I think maybe even the Gmail account, I was like, God, who could this possibly be who's taken up? And I saw the blog, the blog off of that.
This super cyber yeah. stalker.
And I was like, someone's going to try and sell me this for $10,000.
Wait, $10,000? You were going to pay that? I might call my lawyer.
And that's where I ran into Mal. And Mal, what was our first conversation like?
Yeah, so I guess I was the douchebag that had registered at Mortal Realms on Twitter and mortalrealms@gmail.com. I think I had been, similar to you guys, thinking about how could I counteract some of the perceived negativity that there was on the internet about Age of Sigmar. I thought, I'll blog my experience, and maybe then someone's going to care enough about the blog to listen to what I had to say on Twitter. Pretty unlikely, but I think I'd give it a shot. So I did just that. I went for mortalrealms.blogspot.co.uk. At Mortal Realms on Twitter, and then the Mortal Realms Gmail account. And I was sitting there, and the idea was I was just going to talk about my hobby progress, maybe throw up some pictures of some models. And then I got a DM on Twitter from you, Eric, saying, hey, fellow gamer, what's the deal? What are you going to do with this handle? Because and then it transpired that you had the plan to put together some kind of podcast. So we scheduled a Skype date to talk about I guess your ideas, because I found them very interesting. And then I think we spent it was whatever late time a day it was for me in the UK, and you managed to get some time free over there in the States. And we kicked around some ideas, realized that we had very similar aspirations for our kind of how we wanted to share the AOS experience with other people. I guess actually looking back on it, monumentally arrogant of us to think that anyone would really care, but still pretty cool to give it a shot. And so yeah, here we are. You introduced me to Davey. We had a kind of a three-way Skype chat, and then set up the first episode, which obviously dropped a couple of weeks ago. And I think it's really interesting that we're going to try and kind of fight through all our collective challenges. We're 6 hours apart time difference wise. We all have busy jobs. You guys have got the kids as well on top of that. So I think the position that we're coming at the podcast from, which is to really add value to the quote-unquote community, but do it in a way in which allows us to carry on with the rest of our lives and not get completely subsumed with the podcast is going to be interesting. And I think could perhaps provide a bit of a model for others going forward. So I think it's going to be exciting. Does that square with your recollection of the facts?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. It was this thing where Eric got in touch with me. He says, you know, I just had this like 45-minute conversation with this guy who was living over in Wales, and he seems pretty cool. And I was like, okay, well, I'll trust you. Let's do it, and pushed ahead. But I'd say probably that's more than anyone's ever wanted to know about us. Anyone got anything else to pitch in, or we want to move on to the story phase here?
People, you can definitely email us if you want to know anything more about us. But
the origin story.
We'll keep it to there, and you'll learn more about us hopefully throughout the next episodes. What we got on the table, what we're working on, what we're passionate about, the kinds of projects we're putting together. Hopefully, some more campaign stuff. Hopefully we're adding value. That's, we want to bring more fun to the game for ourselves, but also so that the airwaves have a lot more positivity in it too. Cool.
Registration is open for Du Bois GT, a 3-day event in Western New York featuring singles and doubles tournaments at Warhammer 40K, 8th Edition Fantasy, and Age of Sigmar. This is happening November 6th through 8th in Canandaigua, New York, near Rochester. Last year's event had just under 180 total players for the singles event, and lunch is included in the price of admission for Saturday and Sunday. For more information, please check out duboysgt.com, that's duboysgt.com, or by email, duboysrocgt@gmail.com, or on Twitter at CornLord, or using the hashtag DuBoisGT. Good luck, guys.
The story phase.
In the story phase, we delve into the stories, characters, creatures, and environments of the Nine Realms. So for this episode, we're digging into the box set and the accompanying novel/novella, Gates of Azir. So let's for the story phase, let's break down the story behind that. Gates of Azir, this is the first on its own, standalone piece of fiction that we get of the mortal realm. So this is very exciting to jump into, and because that was the biggest thing about this.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, we got excited about the game coming, right? And part of it, we got all these war scrolls dropped on us, all this kind of information, but we needed context. And this first book came out, and I've not bought a single book of from the Black Library, just hadn't. Like I said, there nothing turned me on to it. Nobody told me to go there, etc. But I saw this coming, and I was.
You've got some catching up to do, dude.
No, it's all clean. I'm just moving forward.
he's talking about back in the 8th edition, he wasn't reading any of that. He's staying current with the Age of Sigmar here, but yeah. Yeah, exactly. Dig back through that. If you want to know about the world that was, there is a lot there. But this is the big question mark is, because if we're coming at this from a story direction, you want to know what's the story behind my army? How are they getting established? Who are these Stormcast Eternal guys? And that's what we get to see a little bit of in the Gates of Azir and the box set itself. So,
well, I think something that's really important to think about too is that we learn that there's these mortal realms. There's what are they about? All this kind of stuff. And I think what this novel sets up first and foremost is that there's nine realms or eight mortal realms, but they've just been decimated. All but Azir. It's like they've just been covered in chaos, and I don't know if there's an example of it in like a movie or something where something's covered in this goo right up to the point like the last thing that it covers is their mouth, and they can barely breathe out of it, and then that's where we're at with the mortal realms, is that like Chaos has taken it so far that they're about ready to just suffocate these realms.
Yeah, I think that's this sounds pretty. I'm trying to think of movie references covered in goo. Trying to keep this PG-13. I'm going to go for Ghostbusters 2.
Oh, yeah,
a lot of goo there.
Yeah, Ghostbusters 2. Exactly right. Ghostbusters 2 is the total equivalent here. No, so well, let's get into Gates of Azir here. So, chapter one, we started off. We got Vandas Hammerhand. He's giving his speech. He's got the assembled Stormcast Eternals. They're getting ready to go down. The thing here, they're all stacked up in the gate in the realm of Azir, and they're getting ready to go down. And the whole impetus here that we're getting the idea of is like they've been preparing this for a long time, right? They have been training. All these heroes been pulled away. They've been snapped up. Different chambers have been assembled. There's different themes about different chambers, but in this case, they're pulled in right before they're defeated, right before they die, and they've been reforged into these Stormcast Eternals that are come down, and they're going to get their vengeance on the mortal realms. They're going to come back and take it back, but they've been waiting for a long time. They've been preparing for a long time, but as anyone knows, you know, preparation is one thing, doing is a whole other thing altogether. So this is that preamble. They're getting ready to do it, but they only have some semblance of an idea of what they're getting into. So this is us getting the idea of what happens before they go and step through and get sent down to the mortal realms themselves.
So Mal,
they have a lot of work to do in that first chapter when they're talking about introducing all the different essentially troop types that we know about right now, the Stormcast Eternals. So they talk about, you know, the Liberators being the greater part of the mighty host, you know, and amid the Liberators stood the Retributors, even more imposing than their comrades, with the double-handed lightning hammers, you know, all that kind of stuff. So they've got I felt that Chris Raitt, the author, did a really, really good job in chapter one of the novella of setting the scene. You could read this book without having seen the models or looked at the box set and really get a feel for what the Stormcast Eternals look like, which I thought was a great job on his part.
Well, it's interesting too, is they wanted to start with this strong thing, and I don't know, after Braveheart, you can't really do those big speech before a battle things, right? It's been done, so it's not like the first part is original, but what is original is
drops mic.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, Mel's done this. Vandas is new, but they're in this hall and they try and paint a picture of they're in Azir. They're in the realm of heavens, and the walls of this room that they're in, it's like they're tall as mountains, and the room is just filled with an entire chamber, I think, isn't it? Thousands of Stormcast Eternals, and they're all facing Vandas, and Vandas is the first character that we meet. He's the hero of the story. He's the first Lord Celestant who's going to enter into the mortal realms since Sigmar had closed the gates and you know, started hatching this plan. So this is like that breath that's happening by that person covered in goo. These guys are coming down to, you know, to come and take that out. And I mean, he's an archetype, right? He's not like the most interesting person. I mean, he's the Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Jason Statham or whatever, maybe a little more honor than that guy. But he's definitely the Dudley Do-Right to go another direction. The guy with the heart of gold.
Yeah. So they're coming down. We got it squared away. Now we move on to chapter two, and we find out what exactly it is that they're moving on to. And what I loved about this, this is our first glimpse at anywhere that Chaos has touched. You know, we get to see somehow these people who have survived in specifically one part of the realm of Akshi, the realm of fire, down on the Brimstone Peninsula. And it's these last survivors, and this is for all intents and purposes, this is a post-apocalyptic setting. Like the, you know, this world is dead and gone, and these are just the last survivors. That's pretty interesting to me. And what's cool is that this is flipped on its head from what we've known before, where Chaos are the invaders and they are trying to usurp the order. This is, you know, Chaos is it. There's almost nothing but, and now it's the other way around. And that's pretty fun for the good guys to be, you know, the underdogs, and now here they're coming in, and Stormcast Eternals are going to try and flip that script.
What's really crazy about it is that this chapter two starts with this description of this tribe of humans, and they're just running through the, I guess, which is what we later find out to be the Brimstone Peninsula. So it's a girl called Kalia and her buddies, and talking about how they've been running their whole life. You know, that's all they know is escaping from the kind of chaos hordes, and it really sort of struck me, and without wanting to, you know, skip to the end, spoiler alert, it really struck me that these people kind of, they deserve to be saved. You know, if you live your whole life, we have no idea how old these people are at this stage, but if they've been running their entire life and all they've known is the kind of the pantheon of the dark gods, because what's really interesting is that the first, if I, it even talks about later on in the book, you know, the name Sigmar being uttered in the mortal realms hasn't happened for thousands and thousands of years. So these people have grown up and had their entire existence without even knowing about this, you know, good guy god. All they've known is that that chaos is bad and they want to stay away from him. So they kind of, I guess, the faith that these remnants of the original human population have is incredible. So it's nuts. I would totally have turned to chaos, you know, long time since.
And this, you know, what was cool in this chapter two is it gives you a really good view of what the first realm, the Akshi realm, is, looks like. Just some burnout, and they, you know, one of the places that Kalia and her, I think there's like 20 survivors out of their whole tribe, and, you know, for all we know, these are the last humans. Maybe there's more other places in this realm, but I mean, in a whole continent, maybe this is it. I mean, they've been chased down and used as food. And you know, growing the ranks of the Blood Tide, you know, they run into, in this part of the chapter, they run into this kind of old ruins, these, you know, very tall old things that have been there forever. Nobody knows what this city used to be or who lived there or anything like that. Like the memory of it, the history of it is gone from the people that we see through their eyes in this chapter.
And Mal talked about, you know, he would have turned to chaos ages ago. And that's what's actually the coolest thing for me. For me, it was actually the coolest moment of the book. And I'm not exactly sure how many people would feel the same way. But chapter three, we find out who's chasing. Why are those folks running? They're running because they got a pack of about 50 Blood Reavers running after them. And we find out Blood Reavers are cannibals. And by the way, gamers, if you're looking for a diet, apparently cannibalism is the way to go, because you look at these models and these guys are ripped. So
no, that's because if you're a corn warrior, every day is arm day.
yeah. But what I really liked about this was, this is in a long, long time of reading GW fiction, this is one of the few times where I was reading something about somebody who is a corn worshiper / follower, and I was like, oh, like I can kind of see where they could have gotten to this point. It talks about one specific guy, Rack, who remembers right when he started with the Blood Reavers and how he would almost choke and gag when he was eating the raw flesh, and how they were supposed to. He's like, oh man, I got to make sure I laugh when you know that my victims are screaming, because if I don't show enough enjoyment, then you know, then I'm the next guy to get eaten. And it was one of those rare moments where they somehow found a way to humanize these like crazy barbaric, you know, and for me, a good villain is someone that you can at least identify some part with that really brings them home. So this weirdly was my favorite part of the book, was talking about, you know, the mind of a Blood Reaver.
So which part were you identifying with? The eating of flesh or the feeling guilty about eating flesh?
Well, you know, hand in hand, you know.
It's actually, it's super, super messed up. You know, if you think about it, you know, at the end of the day, this is a game for all ages. But there are some pretty, pretty dark concepts that they touch on there. You know, the kind of when he's, you know, talking about having rocked himself to sleep because he felt so guilty, but now he's like, all these days he grinned to think of it. All had changed now. He'd learned to relish the textures. You're like, oh, that's so nasty. So you don't, yeah, I know. I mean, they humanize him, but ultimately you don't feel too bad about whatever may happen to him, you know, courtesy of the Stormcast Eternals later on.
Well, and what else is, not only has he, you know, himself nurtured that, the taste, but he speaks the utterances of Khorne in it, like, uncontrollably. So blood for the blood god, skulls for the skull throne is what they chant. And it's not voluntary. It's not something that they are like, yeah, it's the chaos god is in them now.
Yeah, and they wrap this up. They're chasing down these last few folks, but these followers of the Blood God get ambushed by even tougher followers of the Blood God. The Corgus Cole comes and snaps them up, adds them to his warband, and it is a, you know, you kind of wonder, what, now that Chaos has won, what have they been doing? And apparently it's fighting each other, you know, because these Blood Warriors and Corgus Cole and Skullbrand,
Threx, yeah.
Yeah, they set up an ambush and jump these guys. And like, all right, so, you know, that totally makes sense. Khorne fighting Khorne, you know. Khorne cares not from whence the blood flows. So you get that glimpse in there, and then these Blood Reavers wrap in, and now you're starting to get that box set force assembled that you're going to get to play on the table itself.
Well, and this is where, you know, to point out, in case it wasn't known, I mean, this book follows the starter set. All of the characters from the starter set are in here. They come out, you get a really good sense of them. Really good. You know, you get that, it wets your whistle on who they are and what they're about and what their rank is in all of this stuff. And you know, it's really cool to tie back to that starter set, and all the models that you have to be able to place them somewhere. Now the model set will, you know, these are somewhat can be generic, you know, the model that Vandis is in the book, it's Vandis, but there's other Lord Celestines writing Dracoliths, we find out. But it is really cool to just kind of give these guys a place and time. These models have a role in that very first part of that we get into the Age of Sigmar.
Yeah, I think that context is absolutely vital because, in 2-3 years' time, we're gonna look around and there will be no requirement for these super scene-setting type of documents or novellas because it'll just be understood. But actually, we have to, you know, and it seems, you know, the game only dropped, you know, 2.5-3 months ago, and already we're like, oh yeah, no, Stormcast Eternals, we know what they are. You know, the Bloodbound, we know what they are. But actually, when the box set first came out and this book first came out, this was all we had, absolutely all we had to put any context to the models that we were seeing. So that's why it was such an important book, why it is such an important book, and why it was, you know, I think they did a great job doing exactly as you said, Eric, which is to introduce the models that you're going to play, because otherwise you're just pushing around lumps of plastic.
Yeah, and but ultimately what we're doing is we're fighting, and so far these forces haven't seen each other, and that's what Chapter 4 does. It brings the Stormcast Eternals down into the realm of Akshi. It's their arrival, and the Stormcast Eternals are finally seeing, here's the followers of Chaos, here's what we have been wanting to fight for ever and a day, you know, let's make it happen. And meanwhile, the Bloodbound are seeing these guys ride in on the Bolts of Lightning. Obviously, they're surprised right off the bat, but what they're seeing is like, oh, we got someone else to fight. We've been fighting each other forever. Now we might have a worthy foe. So, you know, the stage is set for fighting to continue and for those battles that we're talking about in the box set.
Yeah, well, just I want to, before we hit the actual battle with the Stormcast, I just want to call back to one final really messed up thing in Chapter 3, where they talk about the eyes of Khorne, or the Corgus Cull decides that he's is some kind of weird messed up Khorne magic.
Yeah, it's weird. I guess they only barely touch on it, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and Davey, I'd really love you to weigh in on this based on your sort of previous experience with the game and how much we know that Khorne does not like magic of any sort at all. But there's a sequence where it appears that Corvus Cull has a pocket in his armor, a pouch filled with magical eyeballs.
Yeah, you don't have it or what?
So I'm fresh out of magic eyeballs. Right. And he cuts out Rack's eyes, or at least one of them, and stitches in a new magic eyeball, which I guess is like the kind of the GoPro.
Yeah.
GoPro camera, network linked GoPro camera for the Khorne Warrior, and he stitches it in so he can. So I guess Cull can now see everything that Rat can see. He can sort of use him as an advanced scout. Which it really struck me as odd because traditionally Khorne has been super anti magic. I mean that's the whole point. And in the rules, which I know you guys are going to talk about later on, the importance, the collar of Khorne that Cull's big dog Grizzlemaw has, allows him to stop magic. So when did all this, these magical artifacts start appearing around the place, and Khorne was suddenly okay with that? Do you want to talk to that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a distinction between spell casting and items that are blessed. The champions of Khorne are running around with runic weapons and magic weapons and chaos armor and chaos blessed armor. So this is kind of a blood ritual thing. I get more in the realm of, this is a magic item or a blood ritual rather than a spell so much. And that may be splitting hairs, but I think that's where they get away. It didn't really bother me a whole lot, but now that you mentioned, I can see where that's something to consider.
So what does he see through this GoPro? Right. I'll tell you what he sees. So in this time, they're coming down into this ruins that I talked about earlier. And I want to read this part because in this storm that was just like gathering, and lightning is crashing and all these things and the blood tide is kind of, just not, how do I put it? They're not organized. They're just, kind of going crazy. And then I hear it says, speaking of Corvus Cull, "And so it was that he alone saw them come. He saw them borne down from the storm by the white-blue shafts that ripped from coils of shimmering magic. He saw them hurtle from the heart of the turning maelstrom, encased in brilliant cocoons of light. He saw them strike the earth with shuddering force. Where they crashed into the ground, domes of energy sprang up, each one swimming with raging coruscation. Then the dome shattered, spraying fragments of crystalline matter across the burning land, exposing the signs of the storm, the ones delivered by the wrath of the skies. They were tall, taller than the greatest of mortal men, clad in the purest gold and bearing war hammers that glistened with seething energy. Masks they wore, gold as their battle plate, each one gazing impassively out at the devastation around them. Some had pearl-white wings that spread out behind them, bearing them aloft almost as soon as they landed. Others strode out from their broken cocoons, their movements fluid despite the weight of the arcane armor. Their every movement was perfect, poised to perfection and suffused with godlike power. They strode out from the remnants of lightning that had hurled them into reality, hefting their weapons with an eerie fluid power." So that's what Corvus saw with his GoPro eyes, his relics, his blessed. His response was, "Hell yeah."
There's a special type of maniac, I think, that sees that kind of thing and just thinks, the best thing I can do here, when this is something I've never ever seen before. Essentially, you imagine how scary it was at the start of Terminator 2 when the T-1000 just appears in this sort of ball of glowing earth. Then if you imagine a whole army of those, that all happening with cue thunder and lightning. And it's not just a naked dude. It's 100 or so guys, huge blokes with all this metal armor and things. That the best thing for me to do is to go over there and pick a fight. That's why he's a chaos champion, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Blood for the blood god.
Right. Well, Cull, and we'll get to this, but he is looking to he's essentially conquered this part of the realm of Akshi, right? So he is trying to figure out. What do I have left to do? And he's casting about, and it alludes to things. And later books will get into this further. But he has some regrets about you know, about his campaigns thus far. There's things that he wishes he got into.
Well, he definitely, I think in here, if I remember, he does talk about, he's looking for that one skull. He's looking for a special skull. And we don't know why yet. We do, like what you said, we'd learn later on that he has a reason for it, but that skull is only going to be, you know, the skull of somebody who's going to give him some real challenge in battle. And when the storm casts come down in this light, he sees Vandis riding his Drakoth, and he knows exactly whose skull that's going to be. And so yes. He calls. I think he's like, he's not even like right close to it. Like, he's up the mountain a little ways or up a hill, and so he's a ways away. But he calls down, and I think they hear each other. Like, I think it's like this, you know, it's like that time, Davey, when you walked into that room and that girl, you know, and she just turned her head and saw you, and you're just like, yeah. You know, that time where it just all magically happened and came together.
Oh, so many times that happened. So, yeah.
I think it's what's really interesting is that how many sci-fi and fantasy tropes can they crowbar into this one book? Because they're like, oh, I need the skull. So now we're all about, you know, you can just imagine the Predator, and he's like, he's using his thermal vision GoPro at this point to look at Vandis's skull and be like, yeah, that is the skull that I need for the top of my bloody mountain. Yep. It's pretty badass.
Yeah, exactly. So the Stormcast have arrived, the Gortide have seen them arrive, and it's game on. They're gonna get their fight going. And this is where we actually start to see the game on the table meet the novella as it goes. And in these opening phases, so we should touch on the Stormcast have arrived. They've come down by lightning bolts, but the thing is it takes a great effort to come down by these lightning bolts. And I don't think this bit of fiction touches a whole lot on that, but they can't just send down every one of their guys this way. It's a restrictive thing. It would be a good way to think of these as, you know, paratroopers setting up, you know, trying to establish a beachhead, and their goal here is they're going to get to the gate and break it open. They have to break it open from both sides at the same time, and that's what they're doing. They drop down. We're getting into chapter six, and they touch down in Akshi, and they're setting up, engaging, and the prosecutors are blitzing for the gate. They're the fast, speedy ones. They're trying to get there, trying to crack it open, and that's where we start to see that first scenario and the second scenario. The first one is your Lord Celestin. You've got Vandis Hammerhand. He drops in right among a bunch of Korgoraths, and he's got to start fighting them off. And
do you want to try and explain what a Korgorath is real quick, Davey?
Oh yeah, so Korgorath, that's the big monster looking model from the box set, but that can be any beast or creature that has accidentally, you know, for now that chaos is all over the mortal realms, has wandered into the realm of chaos. This specific one got spat out and is this big, you know, big mad blood beast, and direly mutated. They can run in packs or in individuals. Specifically in this background, you see, oh, there's only one in the box set. They frequently are running in large groups, and that means that Stormcast can have their big hero moment and kill a whole bunch of them in a go. So, but that in its broad strokes, it's a beast that's been mutated and shaped to more to Korn's liking, I guess. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, well, you know, we'll talk, you know, later in the episode about the models themselves and how they depicted the fiction in the models and vice versa. But yes, I think the reason the Korgorath's important is that it's the first thing for the bad guys, I guess, that we've definitely not seen before. So Korgoth Skull is a Chaos Champion. Yeah, happy days. He's got a Flesh Hound with him, or what looks like a Flesh Hound. Yeah, all good. We've got some Chaos Warriors. But this Korgorath is a completely new beast in the GW pantheon, and the reason I asked you to try and describe it is because I struggle to do it myself. I'm like, what is this thing? But yeah, we'll get to that later on. Yeah, go for it.
So this is where there's just a big fray, and they do it in stages. So there's a theater where Vandis has taken out the blood secretor, the blood stoker, and a Khorgarath. So the Bloodstoker is this kind of beast master, this torturer, somebody who specializes in bringing things to pain. And one of the thick quotes is that the Khorgarath went after Vandis, regardless of how much he feared this new threat, he feared the Bloodstoker more. And then I think later on, there's something where the Bloodstoker feared Vandis more than the Stoker.
I think the description of him is borne out really well by the model. I think he kind of looks a lot like the Rancor Keeper from Return of the Jedi. The big chubby guy with the hood, and they, so him, and then obviously the Khorgarath would then be the Rancor. So how many more sci-fi influences can we get in here? But this is a good one. You've got this kind of this warrior beast that's going to do whatever its crazy torturing master says.
And so then, yeah, Davey, you said is, so then the next part is the prosecutors, they have to get to the gate and they have to blast it with magic, which is their hammers, instead of being steel hammers, like I think it seems like everybody else has on the team. They've got these kind of lightning magic, heaven's magic hammers, so they can throw them, hit the gate, and then they reach up into basically the air around them, and a new hammer materializes, and they throw another one. And then you've got the retributors with the double-handed hammers, big kind of the big guys that do a lot of damage, create a circle around the gate itself. They form. And who is kind of sitting in with the retributors to defend that gate?
It's Ionis Cripborn, the Relictor. He looks something like a standard bearer, although you'll see later that they actually have a different model for that. So this is scenario three, plays out like this, but they're basically trying to buy time for the prosecutors to make this happen. They're fighting down the hordes, trying to set up in a choke point, while the prosecutors make it to the gate and, try to bust it open, to really establish that beachhead. If it gets cracked open, we're looking at now you can bring Stormcast in bulk, can enter the realm of Akshi. So this, they've dropped in numbers that are not necessarily going to be able to take it and hold it on their own. But if they can buy enough time to break this open, then they can really bring numbers in force. Do you have any thoughts on this section, Mel?
I thought it was really, it's interesting. This is, I think, the first place where, in the book, when it's that kind of, we get to see that the Stormcast Eternals can get messed up. Okay, I think at this point we've had one of the prosecutors maybe get sort of brought down to earth by the Blood Tide, but there's not. Yeah, and he bleeds, which is crazy because we don't, at this point, it's a really good, we don't know what's inside these guys. It turns out it's flesh. But Ionis, he's kind of, we get the sense that he's got all kinds of crazy powers that he can use to shore up the retributors. There's a passage where one of them actually dies or is close to death, and Ionis brings him back to life. So he's kind of he's a weird kind of, is he a medic? Is he the kind of chaplain equivalent? Because without wanting to stray into other game system influences, he does look a lot like the concept of a space marine chaplain. And he's got this kind of dual power where he can bring people back to life, or he can use the winds of magic to call down some destruction on these guys. And he actually invokes Shaiish, the name of the wind of death or the death magic to make that happen. So we're already starting to see and some foreshadowing here for when Ionis talks to Khorgos Khul later on, and then later on in subsequent fiction about what is Ionis, where does he come from, what is the job of a Relictor. And there's an undeniable connection there to the realm of death. So we're going to see that pad out later on, but it's that's I think a crucial part here, that the first time we see Ionis in his deathly ways.
So we were being in this book, we're looking for a lot of things to understand more about the Stormcast Eternals. And one of them is, you know, are what's inside that armor? Is it just spirit armor that moves around that's animated? Those kind of lifeless masks, you know, is there humanity there? And certainly with the, you know, they bleed, right? That's something we find out here so that we know that there's flesh and bone in there, but they're huge, like they're giant people. So they've been changed in that way. We know that the prosecutors, one of the named prosecutors in this book, they talk about how prosecutors are the warriors that had the most kind of like thrill for battle. And so they're flying in their high energy, you know, they're the high octane kind of fighter who's thrilled to be, you know, doing what they're doing.
They're listening to the techno inside their helmets.
Exactly. One of those 80s, you know, Top Gun montages, something like that. And then you've got Ionis, Cryptborn, and who's a completely different kind of character. So where Vandas had this archetype of that, you know, that golden boy hero kind of thing, Ionis is kind of that unknown and this other kind of energy. You know, you don't know he masters death magic and is from somehow connected to the realm of death. So what does that mean? Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? How is he here in this order? You know, his dry humor or his way of, you know, about assessing things is so cold. But then there's the aspect of when the Stormcast die, another bolt of lightning carries them back or their spirit. And I don't know if they're, this book, I don't think explains exactly if their flesh is left there, their armor is left there. But they're born back to Azir to be reforged. And we don't even know what that means at this point. The Relictor, the Lord Relictor, is somehow key in that thing, whether or not they're keeping that spirit from going to the realm of death or being captured by, you know, somebody else. They're part of that kind of formula for keeping the souls of the Stormcast Eternals being able to go back and be reused, making them eternal, making them, you know, able to kind of regenerate their forces, because Sigmar doesn't have unlimited number of these that we find out.
Yeah, and there's the passage later on where Ionis talks to Cull, and Cull says, you know, when Ionis says the word Sigmar, Cull realizes or picks up on the fact that it sounds different or it means something more different than when the regular Stormcast Eternals say it. And, you know, and then Ionis talks about or thinks about the fact there's a connection there with Nagash. There's so much more to come on these guys. And again, we talked about it last episode, how excited we are to find out what the deal is with Ionis and the rest of the Relictors. But back to the battle, because that's enough about him. So what's happening now, guys?
Well, so the prosecutors bust through the Prime. Prosecutor Prime manages to, he's got a choice, like, do I make this one last all out effort and in so doing sacrifice myself or do I try and save myself and push on after? And he goes the route of one last push. The Blood Reavers, Blood Warriors manage to drag him down, but in so doing he cracks the gate open. So gates wide open, and the Stormcast start moving through into the realm of Akshi, into the Brimstone Peninsula in force. And rather than being disheartened by this, Corvus Cole continues along that similar theme of, awesome, I finally have a challenge. Khorne has truly blessed me. I am going to get a fight that I haven't had for years and years. You know, who knows, in chaos terms, could be hundreds of years. So we're moving into chapter 7. He is exhilarated by the chance for another true challenge. And this is the battle is truly joined here, and we're moving on to those last few battles in the box set book 5 and 6, where we start to get the full forces meeting. And here is an interesting thing where we start to get a glimpse of the Stormcast Eternals. Specifically, they all have had previous lives. This is mentioned, but here's where they start to mention in particular with Vandas Blackhand. He used to be, he's Vandas Hammerhand. He used to be Vendel Blackfist.
Blackfist. Yeah, Blackfist.
And he has a history at Corvus Cole.
Yeah,
these guys have definitely met before, and they talk about it from, I guess, from Cull's perspective, and he's saying he remembers that the reason why he's so ticked off about and still so angry is that there was the one race or tribe of people who had resisted his conquest were called the Dire Brands. And their chief had been this guy Blackfist, and it's weird because they talk about how his hands had been charred by the fire of battle, but he was still able to carry the warhammer that had been his kind of signature weapon. And it was just as Cull was about to kill Vendel Blackfist that Vendel Blackfist was taken away on this bolt of lightning up to Azir to become a Stormcast Eternal. And that's, it's interesting because they're starting to flesh out these guys, and I think I was glad that they did it in the book at this point, because there's only at the moment, if you're a faceless warrior encased in your golden armor and all you're doing is swinging your hammer, There's only so far that I think anyone can identify with that. So they needed their humanity, and they needed their little bit of a backstory in the same way as for example Space Marines do, and this is where you start to get it, and it was good.
So yeah, there's kind of that again, that connection between two fated individuals, where they kind of recognize, whether it be in the voice or the way, I think. What is it? Cull says something about the way he swings the hammer that reminds him, and whatever it is. Like I gotta say, I don't care what tropes they use or if it feels like forced. Like this is like, Games Workshop has been using in their stories like tropes and like nods to other things forever. But I don't know. I mean, you've got to read these stories and be like, yep, nope, that's what happened. Like just buy it. It's so much fun to kind of have these moments.
The funniest bit though is that Corvus Cull is such a connoisseur of axe swinging and hammer swinging that he's like, ah, yeah, this is good style. I've only seen that style once before, and it was 1,000 years ago with this one guy that ran away. It's incredible. I think, don't get me wrong, he's dedicated his entire life to swinging his axe, so I can see that could happen, but it's good. It's good.
I mean, you don't get an axe that is connected to the void by being a poor axe swinger, right?
That's true. I was thinking about the first company business that would have gone bust in Azerheim would have been, I know you guys have Home Depot in the States, we call it B&Q or Home Base here, where if you can reforge hammers by just like reaching out and be like, boom, there's my new hammer, now I can put together this cabinet or whatever, there's no need to go down to the Home Depot and buy any tools anymore. And if you've got this crazy I don't know, they certainly don't have that in the tool section of my local DIY store, in an axe that is capable of connecting to the warp, to the void. You're probably going to be able to chop a lot of wood with that bad boy.
No, I actually know the number to get that. So after the show,
you have the part number. Awesome.
Yeah, you just have to join this cult and do some crazy. So I'll let you know about
it's the ultimate loyalty program.
I'll email you. So there's this moment that moment where the two long lost combatants find each other, and they get into battle. And I think, is it at the same time that the gates open and the reinforcements have come? And so it's just kind of all happening. And so these two fight each other, but the Stormcasts are getting more. But the Blood Reavers and Blood Warriors, like there's no end to those. It's just. They don't call them the gore tide. I mean, it wasn't like a gore trickle. They're just more. I mean, this is a horde army. This is not a, I don't know if it would consider chaos previously to be a horde army with marauders and that sort of stuff. But this is truly meant to be, from the story, a horde. There's more Khorne worshippers than there are any other kind of species of anything that exists in any of these realms.
You know. Yeah, and the cynic in me skips ahead to the war scroll for the Blood Reavers. Description: a unit of Blood Reavers can have any number of models.
Yeah, exactly.
Buy more.
Yeah, 80 or more. Yeah, it's the huge tide. But so we're seeing this battle. It's coming to a head, and you have these two combatants who are finally, you know, they have the history, and it lets you get a little exposition other than just, you know, here's a battle scene going on. So they're fighting. There's some back and forth, and we got some good battle scenes, and Vandis is actually about to be triumphant, and then he's struck by a vision, and this is a thing that we're gonna see in future pieces that carries on. You know, these visions, both Corgus Cole and Vandis Hammerhand get struck by these visions, and it's an interesting they have some interesting commentary on it later. But here, Vandis is about to strike that killing blow after a hard fought battle, and he's struck by this vision of Corgus Cole somehow, despite this, being triumphant. And it's this self-fulfilling prophecy where, because of this pause, he's kind of swept away and isn't able to drop that killing blow. What did you think about that moment, Mal?
Yeah, it's interesting. It would be a short, I guess they've got to set up and have a central battle or conflict right at the start of this. And we've got the ultimate good guy so far. We've seen in Vandis Hammerhand / Vendo Blackfist and his old nemesis Corgus Cull. And it's, you know, it would be, you know, it would seem like a waste to have you to have that battle finish or that conflict resolved so early on in the background, to, you know, to have one of them, you know, one of them triumphant. And I think it's really cool that it sets up as we go forward. There are, you know, a number of other short stories that explore how this how the conflict pans out. But, you know, it was cool. I thought it was, you know, the idea that you can just imagine that they're, you know, to go back to Eric's thing about, you know, meeting a girl in the bar and, you know, seeing her, like, oh yeah, that's the one. And then you get a bit closer and you're like, oh no, I've seen you before, this is not going to happen. And yeah,
so this battle, like, it doesn't happen. You know, the Corgus gets away. You know, more and more stormcasts are pouring in through the gate because that's open. We don't have to use that, you know, the paratrooper kind of power. And the, even though there's a tide of the Gore Tide, you know, they're expanding. They're securing that beachhead. And at this point, Vandis is able to take a break, kind of. And you kind of think about some of those, you know, when in war, you know, there's a front line. And so they've done enough work that there's a front line and that there's a calm place. And in this, and this is one of my favorite parts of this book, is some Stormcast find Kalia and her, the remnant, the human remnant, and they you know, have heard her story, and they come and they bring her before Vandis, and this is so cool. You know. Vandis comes over and walks and kneels and is at eye height, right? They see eye to eye after he kneels. I mean, these guys are huge. And he takes off his helmet and it's a human face. And, you know, the finest of, you know, those chiseled in statues in in probably the realm of light. So he is a human being. He's got a face. I don't know if it's Blackfist's face. I don't know if it's a different face or the same face or if it's, you know, whatever. But he's got a face. And basically what they're saying is there is humanity here. I mean, that's something they were trying to figure out. Is there anything left worth fighting for? Sigmar however you want to interpret that. It's not a clear... that. Story isn't clear yet, but he wanted to know, is it worth saving? And they find some humans, and this is what, like, all of these Stormcasts, what they were forged for was them. So, you know, taking back the realms for humanity.
This is an interesting point as well, is that they didn't know what they were going to find, right? I mean, I don't know if that's what you're about to get at, Mal. Like, they are kind of astounded, like, oh my gosh, there's actually survivors here. So as surprised as the survivors are to see the Stormcast arriving, it's vice versa. The Stormcast didn't know if they were going to find it. It's been forever since anyone from the realm of Azir saw any of the other mortal realms.
Well, I think they are definitely very, very surprised to find out there. So when they talk, there's a passage where Vandas is kneeling down in front of Kalia, and he looks at her face and he says, "You are whole." And then later on he says, there had been something else there too, astonishment perhaps. By Sigmar, you are whole. So he's like, they just weren't, even if they were expecting to find some remnants running around, they weren't expecting them to be untainted by chaos. So this is, you know, it's almost like, wow, they are super surprised that anything could remain untainted for so long. And they're very impressed by that. And I think that's why the people, the sort of these tribes that are running around there, this is not the last we're going to see of them. I feel like they're going to be incorporated into the forces of order somehow, because it would be a real disservice to them, you know, not to, because they've done such a good job.
I think that covers everything that we need to say about this book. It's certainly, I think, a good place to start if you want to get to know anything about the Age of Sigmar. But certainly if you want to play the Stormcast and kind of figure out what their motivation is, not only in this one battle, but in general, what they're trying to do in the kind of the work in front of them.
Absolutely. So what do you say we move on to our next section here?
The Hero Phase.
In the Hero Phase, we turn our attention to those of you who want to get started in Age of Sigmar, or share this game with your friends.
Okay, hey everyone, it's Mal here. I'm just putting a small segment together for you to talk about comparison of value, I guess, in the Age of Sigmar starter set. What I'm going to do is talk about the models that you get in the starter set, along with what else is in the box in terms of rules, pamphlets and rulers, etc. I'm going to break that down, you know, how much those models might cost if you bought them independently where available. And then I'm going to talk about how the Age of Sigmar box set compares to a number of other kind of starter sets around available on the market. So without further ado, let's get into it. So the Age of Sigmar box set, what do you get for your £75 in the UK or $125 in the US? Well, first of all, it's 47 miniatures, which is a lot of plastic, and it's great quality plastic. And it's important to say that at the outset. What do they look like? Well, it's two well-balanced, if a little small, starter forces. And there are some what we call box-exclusive miniatures in there. So there are miniatures available in the Age of Sigmar box set which you cannot currently buy individually either. So there's no model, for example, the Khorgorath or the Bloodstoker. But I anticipate that may change in the future. So what do we actually get? Well, there are 10 Liberators, okay? So 8 regular Liberators and 2 Liberator Primes. They're armed with hammers and shields, so the standard loadout. You get 3 Prosecutors, so you've got the Prosecutor Prime and 2 regular Prosecutors, again, both armed with hammers. 3 Paladin Retributors, 1 Retributor Prime and 2 regular Paladins. A Lord Celestant on a Dracoth, okay, so I guess designed to be Vandas Hammerhand. And a Lord Relictor, good old Ionis Cryptborn. So that's everything on the Stormcast Eternal side. And then over on the Chaos side, you get 20 Blood Reavers, 5 Blood Warriors, a Khorne Lord, who's, I guess, Khorgo's Cull, a Blood Secretor, and a Blood Stoker, and a Khorgorath. Now, to break that down a little more in detail, I guess the first thing to say, you know, at the outset is that these are static pose models. Okay, so they're not traditional clip off the sprue. You can decide which way you want to pose these models, and then have you know, them all looking, you know, different, or you may have, or having several weapons options. These are all come with static pose and only one set of weapon options, which I think it personally for me might be a problem later down the line if you're looking to expand your forces. But right now, when you're getting this box to start you off in the hobby, absolutely perfect. So if you wanted to, for example, buy a box of five Liberators, in the UK that costs you £30, so I'm guessing $50-ish dollars in the US, and you get two of those boxes of five Liberators. Again, yep, they're single pose, they only have one weapon loadout, but you know it's pretty good. A box of three Prosecutors would cost you £35. Three Paladins would cost you, well, it's kind of a difficult one for them because the box set of five is worth £35, but you get three in the AOS box set. Lord Celestine on the Dracoth, there is no, that model is a box exclusive, so you can't buy him outside of the box. I figure that he could probably be easily worth anywhere between £25 and £35, so you know $50 upwards based on the amount of plastic that's in that model and the you know other similar size kits. And ditto the Lord Relictor, he's not available outside of the box. I'm sure they will come up with a clan pack model for him, but I would say he'd be around £20-25, you know, same kind of cost if you're a 40k player as a Space Marine captain. So you know you're looking upwards of $30-35. So looking at the Stormcast Eternals, that's roughly, if you were to buy the models separately, again noting that buying them separately would give you access to lots of options, it would be £160 or about $245. So already you're ahead on your £75, $125 that you got from the box set, and that's without taking into account what you get from the Khorne guys. So let's look on to the Chaos now. So 20 Blood Reavers. So to buy them, the boxed a box of 20 Blood Reavers from a GW store, £35. Okay, again, the ones we've got in the set, not multi-weapon, not multi-pose. It's worth saying that actually the Blood Reavers box set that or box of Blood Reavers that you can buy in GW or from wherever is actually a fantastic model set. So it's almost like it's a not really. I think this is probably where the comparison falls down the most. But actually, you are still getting 20 great looking models out of the box set, and actually, given that they're kind of a horde army, you could have a lot of them. Built up and not really worry too much about the multiple poses. It is worth saying, though, actually, that the in the AOS box set that you have you can build them two of the guys as the champion, well, three of the guys as the champion, the Hornblower and the Standard Bearer, or not. So you know, there's a good bit of flexibility in there. Five Blood Warriors, at the moment those are £37.50 for 10, so breaking that down would be about £18.75 for five of them, which is what you get in the box set. Khorne Lord, not available, again, I think maybe £25, so $30, $40 model. Blood Secretor, now I need to double check, I think the last week they did bring out a Blood Secretor model and I think it was about £20, which is pretty much what I would well, it's not the guy with the standard old Skullbrand, but it's pretty similar, but you know that's about £20 worth of model there. And then the Bloodstroker and the Korgorath, I think that could easily be £35 or maybe $55-60 for that kind of, you know, little mini box if and when they release those guys. So I think it's harder to be accurate with the core models, but I think roughly £130, $200 worth of models there. So actually what you're getting is, if you add all that together, it's about $445 or £290, and you trade that off against the £75 or the $125 that you're paying retail for the box set, and that's from a GW store without even getting it discounted elsewhere. It's crazy value. So I think, you know, especially on the Blood Reavers, and the Liberators and the Prosecutors as well, to a lesser extent, you know, absolutely fantastic. You know, why it's a total no-brainer. So having talked about how I think the AOS box set is great value, let's just really quickly compare it against some of the other boxes that are out on the market just now. So looking at 40k, for example, the Dark Vengeance box set costs in the UK £65, $110 in the US at retail. 49 miniatures, a rule book, And I realized I didn't even talk about the rule books in Age of Sigmar. I'll come back to that at the end. There's no fluff contained in the Dark Vengeance rulebook, and there's a number of missions and scenarios that come along with it. But the crucial thing I feel is that even though there are slightly more models, including a few in-box exclusives in the Dark Vengeance box set, they're actually a less viable force than the starter set for Age of Sigmar. The reason for that being that there's no force org restrictions in Age of Sigmar, so actually it's still very good value miniatures wise, but it has a number of limitations vis-a-vis the AOS box set. Next, I want to talk really quickly about the Warhammer Island of Blood box set, so the 8th edition starter set, which you can still get around the place. I've seen it on sale for about £50 or $76. Now, here's where it gets tricky. It contains 74 models, Skaven and High Elves. And given that there are War Scrolls available for all those models, and the rules are available free for the AOS starter set, and actually there's an Island of Blood War Scroll as well to help you make the most of it, that box set represents great value for money and a great way to get into AOS on the cheap. Now, my main concern would be a question of the long-term usability of the High Elves in terms of where they're going with the fluff. We've seen Skaven already in Galmaraz and the Age of Sigmar hardback book, so they are firmly in the Mortal Realms. Not so sure about the Elves or whatever they're going to look like just now. But even if you bought the Island of Blood box set just for the Skaven stuff, you're getting 40 Clan Rats, 2 Rat Ogres, a Warlord, a Master Moulder, an Engineer, a Warp Lock Thrower, and a Poisoned Wind Mortar. Now, being conservative, I worked that out as about $120, so £120, or about $170 US. And there's obviously some box set exclusive models in there. So I think if you're a Skaven player, or if you have ambitions to be a Skaven player, if you can find the Warhammer Island of Blood box set, it is incredible value. It wasn't really a viable starter force in 8th edition, but I think if you wanted to get, it's even better value than a Skaven battalion, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, let's talk about maybe some other non-GW game system real quick. Hordes from Privateer Press is £80 for 20 models. War Machine, £80 for 17 models. Okay, some of those models are quite big. And I'm not here to sort of talk smack about which company puts out the better models. But what I have tried to do is stay with all plastic starter sets, which are kind of marketed as being all you need to start playing. So, just to really quickly talk about the other things that come in the AOS box set, which I forgot to say because I was getting too carried away with the models. You are going to get the rules pamphlet, which is the 4 pages, which is, yeah, for sure it's available for free, but it's printed on quite a nice firm cardstock, so you can carry around the place. You are going to get a scenario book, which is going to tell you, well, it's a sort of a book which has this sort of starter fluff for the Age of Sigmar, and then it's going to have 6 war scroll scenarios to take you through, you know, getting started in the game. And they're not overly complex, but there are some cool ideas in there, and they tell the story of what we talked about earlier in the episode with the Gates of Azir. So you can reenact it on the tabletop once you've enjoyed the story. So, I mean, I think when you combine that with the fact that you get some dice in there as well, I mean, you really do have everything you need to start playing Age of Sigmar legitimately in the new box set. And I think that's the first time we've seen that for a little while from GW. So I'm stoked with it. Comparing it back against 40K, Out of the Blood and the other companies, I really think the AOS box set is an absolutely great way to get started in the game, and I would fully recommend it to anyone who wanted to give AOS a shot. So I hope you found that little expose useful or informative. Certainly it was really, I found it very useful to go through and work out exactly how much all this kind of stuff was cost separately, and it just, you know, reaffirmed how great a box set it is. Okay guys, I'll see you next time. Thanks.
So accompanying the release of the Age of Sigmar box set, there's a number of other peripheral or support items. And the value of these, especially from the perspective of a new player to Age of Sigmar, a new player to wargaming in general, the value of these is going to depend entirely on what gets people started, what gets people excited about playing. So we'll take a quick look at some of those and discuss some of the ups and downs here. An obvious big one to start with is the background, and that's where the Gates of Azir, the novella little book, and we just talked extensively about it back in the story phase. That's one way to get an understanding of why those models are hitting the table. If you've got a player that the background is important, they want to know why what is happening is happening, this is the place to get started. And it's $8 ebook, $15 hardback, so the ebook's the cheap way to go. But the hardback is something to consider, especially if you're the driver behind your local area. Pick that up, get your name in it, and then use that as a loaner. Say, hey, you know, are you interested? Check this out. This is what's going on. Here's some pictures of the models. Take a look at this. This is why they're fighting. You know, you kind of read that player. If the background's something that's important to them, that might be something that gets them over the hump. I know a lot of people, especially if they're coming from the old Warhammer, they say, well, I don't know what's going on. This gets them started. So it's something to consider. It's not a bad place to start, and the price point's not too bad either. As far as the painting guide, that released at the same time, there's another different prices, $30 physical, $24 ebook, or $20 if you buy it through the app, and we'll touch on the app again in a second. But if you got somebody who's been painting for a real long time, ourselves who've been doing this hobby for long enough, maybe there's not a bunch to gain out of it. If you got somebody who is maybe painting for the very first time, that pamphlet that comes with the book, it's got some step-by-step get somebody started. If they're excited but they want to know more, this isn't a bad way to go. And again, $20, if that's really going to pull them into the hobby, it's kind of a drop in the bucket. So you could take a look at that. Obviously, there's a whole bunch of internet resources out there. It's sometimes easy to get kind of lost in the vast ocean of what's available. And so what's nice about this is it points right there. It's very specific to the game being played and the models in the box set. But if you're someone who, if you have a player, either yourself or another new player who's starting out and not using one of those forces right out of the box set, the Bloodbound or the Stormcast, then that painting guide, the Age of Sigmar painting guide, maybe not for you. There's some useful basic tips, but you might want to look out. But if you're doing one of those specific forces, that's not a bad place to drop your money. Another consideration here is transport. Now, alongside the box set, they dropped these figure cases. They're going for $140 a piece. Looking at them, they're cool. Very difficult to say if they're $140 cool. You know, they have the emblems to mark your allegiance to one side or the other. But the point here is less about saying, like, this is a good buy, because really, I mean, even within Games Workshop's line, you've got some more efficient options. But let's say you're bringing a new player in, or you yourself are a new player, transportation of your models is something to consider. Now, one advantage you have right out of the box set is the models are plastic rather than metal, so they're less likely to damage each other by flopping around. Certainly, we've all seen new players, or we've been that person who just kind of chucks them into the box itself. They're all kind of loose and sliding around. That'll do okay. We'll look in a little more in depth at some of the transportation options that are out there. But it could be as basic as putting a little shelf liner, non-slip liner, down at the bottom of a container shelf and just laying your models out and being careful when you transport them. I'd suggest to any of the veteran gamers out there who are trying to build their community up a little bit, I know I can go down, take a look in my basement, and I have all the transportation solutions from my prior years, and that from the most basic cases to some of the things that I'm using now. Those most basic cases, they're just kind of sitting there collecting dust. If you've got someone who's excited, has put some time into painting their models, and consider, like, handing off maybe as a loaner, or you know, selling, or even just giving, you know, something like that. If that's something to help get somebody to be part of your community, that's something you want to consider. You want to help them find that transportation solution that's going to work for them, and maybe save them from dropping, thinking that they need to drop $140 on something to transport things with. Oh, so almost forgot. Age of Sigmar app, definitely worth a mention. Had a kind of a rocky start, but at the time that we're recording this, we're looking at two or three major upgrades. 100% free, comes on Android, Google Android, and iOS devices. And specifically from my perspective, I've been looking at it on the iPad. I've seen some Twitter of some issues that it's had on iPhone. But again, free. It's something to check out, something to recommend to somebody who's interested, because when we're looking at this, you've got every War Scroll is on there. Every War Scroll is free. War Scroll battalions, a number of them are free. You need to pay for them if they're from a specific book, unless you buy that book in app, which currently I don't know that I'd recommend. The browsing on them is getting better, but it's still it still seems to be better outside the app, even if you're going electronic. And but you know, it's an option in there. But it's a great way to be able to browse through if you got somebody who's just interested, just wants to take a browse, wants to be total minimal investment, free app. Let them take a look. They can look at the rules. They can look at the War Scrolls, see what the variety is out there, and get themselves started in Age of Sigmar. So great starting point, and can't beat free. So worth checking out. So I think that covers about everything we wanted to hit for the hero phase. We're going to hop over to the hobby phase now.
The hobby phase. So in the hobby phase, we want to stoke the flame of creativity for the hobbyist and find shortcuts and easy entry points for new gamers, because that's part of what we want to do here is encourage new gamers to get into the hobby part, which can be somewhat daunting. And I don't think these new models cut any corners or are in any way simplistic. That might be like, oh, for a new hobbyist to be like, oh yeah, I could just paint that up. So I think it's worth taking some time to try and figure out, you know, those sorts of things.
This is a good point. And Mal's talked a little bit about other box sets, other starter sets. These are not your snap fit. You know, I remember, Mal, did you do second edition 40K? Do you remember that?
They had the big push fit. Some of them weren't even push fit. They're like single piece models. In fact, maybe the Gretchen. They were groundbreaking for the time. Don't be wrong, but I think that. Yeah. But what we're seeing now is this is 2 decades worth of experience from the company coming in, and this is what groundbreaking looks like right now, because these quote unquote snap fit models are insane.
Well, yeah. So it's interesting to me, and actually, I've not assembled these, so you guys can talk to it more, but. From what I see of these, you know, this is a well away from those push fit, snap fit models. These, you know, if you can do these, you can do any of the GW miniatures.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned Nagash before. It was one of the first models that I put together where I had to like keep it in sub assemblies and just was amazed at like how things were cut apart. I've since seen a few other, you know, going back to a few other models where it's not just like, okay, two halves go together, where there's some more nuances to the kind of single model character kind of things, where they're, you know, a little more complex. But so first of all, yeah, I mean, these are high quality. The starter set models are high quality. They are models that you would want to have, you know, that you would want to spend, that you can easily do quickly, I think. So that's something I'll touch on later, but you can easily do them quickly. But if you wanted to bring them, hobby them to a high standard, they're worth doing that too, you know, which is really cool. And assembly-wise, there were certainly a couple of pieces here and there that were, you know, like the way a torso fit into the armor or that sort of thing was a little less than intuitive, but it wasn't impossible by any means. It wasn't terribly difficult. I would say Vandas, the Lord Celestin on the Korgorath. Sorry.
Which box set did you get? That sounds awesome.
Oh, I kit bashed that. on the Dracoloth. Was probably the least intuitive to put together. All the different pieces fitting in such weird ways. But the layering that you get because of how they do that, and you can see that in a few other models, like there's depth. There's layers to the model that you put together. There's layers of plastic. There's an inside part of the model. There's an outside part, and there's, you know, that sort of thing. So there's just the models themselves.
I think as a general point, I found the the chaos stuff did go together slightly more easily. Especially considering the Corgus Cull model with the Mighty Lord of Khorne with his flesh hound. That's a deep three-dimensional model, but it still fitted together very easily without any huge problems. I think the only on the chaos side, the only thing that I had any real problems putting together was the sort of the hairdo on the blood secretor. You know, where he has his has his ponytail threaded down through the spine of who knows what. So I'm pretty sure that my version of that does not look like the example in the box, but it's close enough.
Yeah. That's interesting to hear you guys talking about the assembly. But one cool thing, we talked about the depth, but also the motion in these models. Like that was the thing that struck me looking at them. I would say for me, the prosecutors on the Stormcast side and actually the Blood Reavers on the Khorne side just have such a sense of movement. And honestly, it's highlighted by it being on these circular bases, which we don't need to get way into, but you just look at them, they look like they're racing across the battlefield, and that it really helps with the immersion. I don't know how they were to put together, but the models showing that much movement is a really big deal for me.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, going from a ranked up system, I loved putting together ranks and getting them to fit and having, weird standout models, but still kind of, I don't know, it's like a puzzle, right? You try and make it fit, but you did have to like number everything the exact same way. Having them, it goes back to what we said in the first episode, that Age of Sigmar, I think, strives to and intends to be more cinematic. And by allowing them to be on rounds, I mean, round is the circle. Now I'm going to go back to my profession, logo design, all that kind of stuff. People, more often than not, if they're going to create a logo, stick it in a circle than anything else. Like it's something that's so pleasing to us as human beings. I'm not saying it's right to stick your logos in circles. I'm not an advocate, but it's something that's a part of us. The circle is such a something we're so attuned to, and so to have things on circles and ovals just feels good. And then the motion, the feeling like they're charging in, and that you get that too with the. With the Liberators, they're so solid and their stance is so firm, which is part of their character. They play as much more, resolved kind of army, whereas the Chaos is so like all in, just throw your bodies against it, kind of thing. And the sculpts fit that kind of mood.
Yeah, and they're big as well. I don't know if you have put them next to an Empire or a Bretonian model from the world that was, but these guys are huge. I mean, that really helps with the imposing, I guess, the weight that the model has. It's really it's super well done. I mean, I don't know if you guys have ever tried any kind of sculpting as part of your modeling, conversion type stuff, but I've never tried to do like a whole model, but I've done parts of it. It's just to even get an arm or a leg looking in any way dynamic or pleasing to the eye is so hard. But for them to have knocked it out of the park, I think, with every single one of these models, the last time I saw them do anything like this was the Space Hulk box set, and everything was just, it was the detail on them, the dynamism of the poses was incredible. And that was only 4 years ago, and they've done it again. They've stepped it up. This is it's off the scale.
Yeah. I, as far as sculpting that sort of thing, the limit of my sculpting anything is filling in joins, and I somehow messed that up. So I don't know. Eric can talk to that a little bit more.
I kitbash more than anything. I look for somebody else's sculpt to cut off another model and put it onto the models I like. Mal, have you done more sculpting, or have you?
So the only my biggest kind of sculpting project I've done is I have a from my Khorne Demon King army in 40k. I have a Bloodthirster, which is converted from a Bestigor. What's the huge, you know, the huge beastman kind of giant goat thing? I can't remember. Bestigor. No, I know Bestigor.
No, the Bestigor is the unit. You got the Cygor.
Yeah, that's the one. The Gorgon. So it's converted from a Gorgon. And what I did was they come with two pairs of arms. And so I got rid of the top set, and I jammed in a pair of Dragonforge resin wings onto there, and I had to sculpt all the musculature and then the fur on top of it to make it look kind of like it belonged. And then I also sculpted a whip that the guy has in his right hand. I'll throw some pictures over to you guys, and then
I was about to say, if there's not something up on the blog yet on it, then
yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that for sure. But that's it. So that's the extent of my sculpting, which is not, you know, it's compared to some of the stuff that's on the internet, it is kindergarten level stuff.
Yeah, but bringing it back to the box set itself, there's how much did you guys find that you had to be filling gaps or doing it at sculpting? Like, I'm just looking at Eric's models here. I'm not seeing a whole lot.
Yeah, the hardest part was on the Stormcast, one of the joints was on the shoulder pad. You can kind of see where the mold line goes right in the middle of that. And I know in the standalone box, it doesn't do that. They're separate shoulder pads that glue on, so you don't get that mold line there. But it wasn't too terrible for me.
Did you use liquid green stuff or anything to do that? I mean, I just thought it was such an odd decision about where they would split that part of the model, and I'm sure they didn't do it lightly, because you know they've been making models, painting models for a long, long time. But yeah, you know, I figured that just a bit of liquid green stuff and a tiny bit of sanding actually made that go really, really well.
Yeah, the other one, and you can get this tip elsewhere, this isn't necessarily mine, but using plastic glue, getting enough on there to melt the plastic, and then squeezing together hard enough to let a little bit of that goop pop up, and then you know, once that dries, being able to just use a scraper to scrape it smooth. So, that's how I did it.
Cool.
So we've kind of touched on the assembly. As far as I'm picking up, again, from you guys, the Celestin on Dracolith Vandas here, and the joins, figuring out how you're gonna accomplish those are kind of the challenges. You got any other tips for somebody who's assembling these models,
or is that— I think that from my perspective, that's pretty much it. The rest of them are really super easy to do, and we'll come on to the painting shortly, but I think, yeah, it really was only those things. It was the kind of, or maybe actually when you're trying to put the collar piece on the flesh hound on Grizzlewaw, that you kind of have to try hard to make sure that matches up. But that's really that's a minor thing. Other than that, the Blood Secretor ponytail. But no, these are for a starter set, as with models that look as dynamic and complex as this, I think we've got very, very little to complain about.
So how about painting then? We're looking at the big thing. I know both of you have painted up your Stormcast in different ways. You've picked a chamber or a color scheme first, and then decided a chamber. Like, that there's the first opportunity you have right out of the gates for customizing and doing your own thing. That's where new players or veteran players coming back are going to have the chance to put their own mark on the box set. What are you guys' thoughts? Where'd you guys go with it?
So, I think I may have made a bad decision here. So the Retributor Gold Spray came out, and I thought that looks amazing. I'm going to go with and paint these guys up exactly as they appear in the starter set. My reasoning behind this, it's complex. So, I mean, we've talked about other podcasts that we enjoy listening to, and the Independent Characters is one that I'm a particular fan of. And the host of that show, Carl Tuttle, decided to go with Ultramarines because he felt they were the poster boys for Space Marines, and therefore no one or fewer people would
have that army as a result. And I went for the same kind of logic. Well, I'm going to paint the Hammers of Sigmar all in gold. Are probably going to be the poster boys for the Stormcast Eternals. Therefore, probably not that many people will use them. So if I go for that that chamber or that Brotherhood, then I'm probably going to look kind of unique. And then looking around the interwebs and every single GW store, I think I may not be the special little flower that I thought I was, because there's a lot of gold Stormcast Eternals, but I've decided to go for that. And part of the reason was I wanted to try the new Retributor gold spray, and B, I'm very lazy, so that if I can use a spray painted base coat, either with an airbrush, or in this case even easier, direct from a rattle can, then I will. So that's what I went for. Just and the kind of my method was all over with the Retributor gold spray, wash them then with the Reekland flesh shade, and then dry brush them up with Retributor gold, just the paint from the pot, and then I hit that with some Auric armor gold, or whichever Golden Griffin, yeah, is the dry paint for the gold, and then some Necron compound, which is the dry paint for the silver, right on the edges. So almost before I put any blue or any red anywhere on the models, those they had real kind of warm golden colours in the depth and the recesses of the model, but then they had that kind of highly burnished sheen on the very edges with the silver. And that, I think, that's not testament to any painting skill that I do or do not have. What it is testament to the fact that the products you can get nowadays to make stuff look incredible with so little effort they've come such a long way in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, that's a whole discussion in its own. But I do remember painting as a 13-year-old, and between my abilities as a 13-year-old and the products available to me at the time, just the results, don't compare. But yeah, so Hammers of Sigmar from Mel. Eric, what had you been doing with yours?
Well, so right before Age of Sigmar came out, I had dabbled a little bit into 40K, and so I have a Skitarii army. That just a small one that I put together. And then referencing the same podcast, Independent Characters, listening to some of their episodes, like even not playing 40K, I was like, oh, Space Marines are really cool. That backstory, that interesting kind of way about going and the Horus Heresy stuff and all that kind of stuff was really cool, and they introduced it to me. So I was actually thinking about creating a Space Marine army just to be able to create a chapter and kind of explore what the color scheme would be and all that kind of stuff. So then Age of Sigmar dropped and all the similarities were there. Yeah. So my guys, I've named them with some help of some friends, the Empyrean Purifiers. So they're purifiers of heaven with that. And they have basically a silver base. So I used just a kind of like a lead belcher, kind of a crude silver base, and I painted everything up in the Stormcast side that first, just basically, rough brushed it. And then there's gold accents, so using the new Retributor gold. So the tops of the shoulder pads are gold, the top of the shield, some of the cool spots. And then their shield is white. Their faces are white, so not the crown above it is gold, but the faces are white. And then they're primarily got kind of that a dark red, the wrappings of their weapons are red, and then my primes have blue capes, and so they've kind of got, but they're kind of have a dirty look to them. So they're not. It's like my thinking is that after they've been fighting, I mean, they're dirty, they're grimy. The shields that have the white, that white has been chipped away. And that sort of thing. So thinking about, they're purifiers, but that like it wears and it rubs and that sort of stuff. And this little bit of story behind them is that they're not the first guys in, but they make sure that that there is absolutely no chaos left in wherever they're at. So, the first, they're not the ones hitting the Gortide, they're not the front line. They're making sure that every last single bit of anything and is just erased. So they're thorough in that regard. So that's kind of my story for my change.
They are. That sounds. I've only seen a couple of pictures that you sent over and on Twitter, but they're coming along really nicely, man. They look great. I don't know. Have you? I saw also on Twitter today, and I guess we're going to probably look at this book in an upcoming episode, but I picked up the Order Battle Tome for the Stormcast Eternals today. I think you got it also. There's some really good pictures in there of all, I think, you know, another 8 or 10 new storm hosts that you can use as inspiration. So there are, you know, you can, there are a ton of different resources that you can draw from already in terms of trying to put together your own storm host. The reason I didn't, other than the fact that I'm lazy and wanted to use a retributor gold spray, is that I was concerned that I would basically end up painting something that looked like a Space Marine chapter, because I wouldn't be able to sort of dissociate the process for that in my mind, and that, you know, that would, there's already enough comparisons between the Stormcast Eternals and Space Marines, and I felt I didn't need to contribute anything more to that debate by essentially painting up some more Blood Angels or some Sons of Medusa.
Absolutely. Now for my Gortide, I just want to say real quick, for especially for those who are getting into the hobby, this is the perfect faction for getting into it and hobbying, like at a, you know, when you're first getting in. Here's what I did for them. So I'm not a Chaos fan, but I really wanted to build these guys up, as Davey mentioned last time, like he had offered to paint them. I was like, I'm kind of interested. And so what I did is I basically picked, I painted them basically all a dark red. I picked out their flesh tones, and I picked out their weapons. And for the Blood Reavers, I just used a metal color, a silver metal. For the everybody else, and I haven't gotten to the characters yet. I've started at the low level first, because those are the easiest to assemble, and the easiest to paint. So for the Blood Warriors, I painted them all this brass color. And what did I use? I used Rune Lord Brass. And I thought it was just this awesome kind of cold color, but just absolutely different than the gold and the silver of the Stormcast. And then I painted details of red. I used Agrax Earthshade to wash them to get that on there. And that's it. I haven't highlighted them yet. I don't know that I will yet. But for getting them on the table, having them look cool, like it hits the mark for me. At some point I'll, you know, be able to go back to them and do some highlights, I guess. But they just come to life with there's so much detail, and you would think, and I guess I'll put this here out there. You'd think that the detail would be what would like make you like a little daunted to paint these things. But the amount of detail allows a wash to be so effective at making it all pop, that I think it's sometimes that detail makes it easier to paint something. Like I have my hardest times when I'm trying to paint a big flat surface.
Yeah, totally. Trying to paint any kind of vehicle or tank in 40K is hard work compared to some of these models. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yep. So I would say the Warriors were probably the most time consuming because of trying to get some color in between the flat parts of the armor and let the raised parts be, you know, brass. But you know, it was so easy to keep it clean because there was these deep recesses to paint inside of. So if you're new and you know, you're picking up in any of these, the detail makes it so much easier to I guess paint in the lines, as I would talk about it. And to me, that was the first thing I tried to do as a painter picking up a new hobby, and I hadn't done any miniature painting prior to starting Ogres. Just paint cleanly in the lines, pick out your colors and block it well, you know, contrasting between things so you can easily tell where one thing starts, another thing ends. Wash it with a tone that you feel like you're being consistent, whether that's a brown tone or a black tone or a red tone or whatever. There's many of those options through the GW range and other ranges. And then, you know, let that be where you go. If you want to go further, if you want to learn how to do more in shading and that sort of stuff, great. That's what I did with my Gortide. I have not, like I said, on either faction, I haven't gotten to the characters yet because there's so much there.
I'm still on the foot soldiers. I was going to ask you though, have you used the decals or the transfers on your Stormcast Eternals?
I haven't. I wasn't going to. I was going to try and freehand that part, but I think I'm going to use the decals after all, because I think it'll be pretty clean. It'll be bright and it'll be consistent. So I think I'm going to use the decals. And it turns out I wasn't sure how to use the decals before, but pretty clearly the Liberators have the Thunderbolt. I think the Prosecutors have the Comet. The other ones, the Judicators have the, are they the Star?
Let me get this right. Yeah, so you've got to have the Crescent Moon is on the.
You guys are a bunch of Stormcast Eternal nerds. I'm not on to the color of blood.
The Crescent Moon is the Paladins. The Lightning Bolt is the Liberator. So I think it's more complex than this, and we'll come on. And hey, Davey, if you want to sit out the Stormcast Eternals nerd fest episode, then that's cool. But there's a lot of detail in how in the particular conclave that the guys come from. So it's a Lightning Bolt if you're in the Redeemer Conclave, which is where the Liberators come from. Twin Tail Comet from the Angelus Conclaves, which is where the the Prosecutors come from. The Paladins are from the Paladin Conclaves, so that's where the Liberators Retributors, and that's the Half Moon. And then the Star is the Judicator, the Justicar Conclave, so that's where the Judicators, all the ranged weapon guys, come from. Done.
Done. We got to figure it out for you. So no, and the decals are really cool, and they give you, they're very simple. But I've never used decals before. So.
Well, I think one of the great things about these decals is, and the design of the Stormcast Eternal shoulder pads is such that you can put and the way that interfaces with the design of the decals is absolutely perfect. One of my biggest frustrations has been for many years trying to get the Space Marine shoulder decals that come in the box sets to go on Space Marine shoulder pads. The curve just doesn't work together at all. So you end up messing around trying to make small cuts or use Microsol or Microset to kind of soften up the transfer of the decal. But actually with the Stormcast Eternals ones, they just work straight out of the box. So what I do is I'll paint up the shoulder pad and then I'll put a layer of the gloss varnish on there, just to provide a smooth surface for the decal to go on, and then you stick the decal on top of it and then hit it with some lamia medium, the sort of the pigmentless paint, which acts as a matte varnish, and then that just takes the shine off it, and it looks seamless. They've stepped up their game. It looks really good, and I commend the transfers to you.
Fair enough. Yeah, we've kind of really dug into hobby as it relates to the models you're getting out of the box set. You guys, either you have anything, any last thoughts you want to throw in there?
Nope.
I mean, I think that, I guess I would just say that the starter box provides, if you're going to get into the Stormcast or into the Khorne, this is definitely the box set to get. We talked about the cost earlier in the episode and how much value is here. You've got, I mean, even though that the Blood Reavers have a ton of detail, they're simple. They're simple to put together. They're simple to paint. And you go all the way up to, the Lord Calistent, who has a lot of detail, and the Corgus Cole, who has a ton of detail and dimension. So you've got kind of like this range of difficulty for the hobbyist. So getting into the starter set, I think, has it all. I can't recommend these models enough for the value, for what they are from a quality standpoint, and painting them has been a blast.
So let's move on to the next phase. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Here we go.
The campaign phase.
In the campaign phase, we explore how the plastic hits the table, rules, scenarios, new tactics, and narrative campaigns. This time around, we're going to take a look at the scenarios coming right out of the box. Specifically, we're going to look at the two armies for each scenario, what war scrolls are involved, maybe talk about some of the unit synergies or tactics and how it plays on the table itself. And we'll also take a look at how it ties back to the stories that we just talked about.
Now, we haven't done this before, obviously, for the podcast. We're, you know, trying to figure it out like everybody else, how to, you know, talk about these battle plans. There's so many of these. Let's get started with the first one.
Sounds good. We kick it off with no quarter. Now, no quarter is when right when the Stormcast Eternals are coming through actually come down. They're not coming through a realm gate. They're coming down the lightning strike, and they're arriving. And one of the first things that happens in the book is that Vandas Hammerhand is confronted by a Korgorath and also a Bloodstoker, in this case a specific one named Vec. So this is just setting that up, and it's about as basic as you can get. And again, you know, we may not be in the hero phase right now, but this is a good point to bear in mind that all these will be good for if you're comfortable with the game already. These are good ones to teach a new person. So this one, so much so that you can actually play it just solo.
Definitely. So the first one, the armies in No Quarter consist of the Lord Celestin on Drakoth. In the story, it's Vandas Hammerhand. And for the Gortide, one Bloodstoker and one Korgorath. The battlefield is played 24-inch square. So, and you can set up scenery using the rules from the four pages. So you can give them the different features or such. The setup, the Lord Celestin is set up in the middle of the middle of the board. And then the Korgorath and Bloodstoker are set up within 3 inches of each other and 1 inch from the edge of the battlefield. The glorious victory is when one side is wiped out. So there's only three models here. So, you know, really it's a quick play. They charge in towards each other and get into battle. And then like Davey said, you can play this solo. And it's things like if the Korgorath or Bloodstoker are more than 3 inches away from the Lord Celestin, they will move straight towards him. So it gives you just what they would do in these certain circumstances.
So on the one side, we've got the Korgorath and Bloodstoker. The Korgorath is kind of one of the heavy hitters. What's fun about this is we've got some of the big fancy models. So when you're just starting somebody off with the game, you get to use these ones. Korgorath's got a minimal shooting attack, but it's something. And actually, when we were playing, managed to scrape a wound or two off there. And then also, crucially, he's got some rend. The Bloodstoker himself, Vec, he doesn't have a whole lot of damage output. His big thing is that he can buff somebody else. In this case, the only thing he's got available to buff is the Korgorath, but it really amps that up, and it presents an interesting challenge specifically to the Lord Celestin, to Vandas, because he's got to figure out, do I smoke the Bloodstoker before he whips up the Korgorath and reduce that, or do I need to make the early progress on the Korgorath? You know, specifically that Bloodstoker, he's going to improve the charge capability of the Korgorath, an extra 3 inches on runner charge, which doesn't come into play, but the big one is the reroll of wound rolls of one, and when that Korgorath's already wounding on threes, that's a big deal. Korgorath's got some additional abilities. They don't really come into play in this one. They involve battle shock or healing wounds when he kills somebody. He's not going to cause battle shock because there's only one model, and he's not going to worry about healing it, because if he's killed killed Vandas, he's already won.
So. And Lord Celestin's coming in movement 10, so he's getting across the board pretty quick. 3-up save, 9 bravery, and 7 wounds. But it's not just him. He's also got the Drakoth that he's riding that's shooting, and that played a really big role in this one, obviously. When he's going in against big units or single characters, the Drakoth has a shooting attack. It's called Storm Breath. You can make the Storm Breath attack in the shooting phase. You pick a point, and this is kind of a misconception. There's no templates per se, but this is a template weapon, right? You pick a point and everything within 2 inches. So it's basically a 4-inch wide plate. And on a roll of 4 or more, the unit begins being rolled for suffers D3 mortal wounds. So you have a potential of just knocking 3 mortal wounds off of either of these guys. And there's no joke there. Korgorath's got 8, so you're knocking him down to 5. Now, Korgorath, I don't think he's a monster. So that wasn't, he's not, oh, he is a monster, but he's not changing his stats or anything as he goes down, like some of the monsters in other case going. Otherwise, Vandis, you really want to get him in on a charge, his Inscapable Vengeance. If he's made a charge move, he gets to make D3 extra attacks with his Tempestuous Hammer. And that hammer is a three up to hit, three up to wound. He's got three attacks with it too. Ren minus one and damage D3. So again, another ability to take off a lot of wounds on something. Intolerable damage if the wound. So this is back to the Drakoth. Sorry, if the wound roll for the Drakoth attack is six or more, then that attack has a damage characteristic of D6 rather than one. So you know if you get he's got three attacks when he's in melee, and can do a ton of damage if you roll that six. Lord Celestine's command ability doesn't really come into play in this battle because he can, use the regular command ability of Inspiring Presence, giving one unit unity battle shock. But we'll talk more about how he can give every Stormcast Eternal unit within 24 inches immunity battle shock, but it's not as simple as you might think. We'll talk about that in a later combat. So these are our units going ahead, three War Scrolls in this. Now, through all these games, I played the Stormcast, and Davey played the Chaos because he's just an evil son of a gun. So this one was pretty straightforward, though. I mean, nothing too exciting. I think, like you said, at one point I had to decide, charged in. I think I'm pretty sure I got the charge that I needed to get with Lord Celestine. And I had to decide who was I going to go after. I didn't charge both of them together. I think I was able to charge around to the opposite side of the Khorgarath. So at least that very first round of combat, even when the Stoker piled in, I don't think he could get all of his attacks in. Getting the opportunity to shoot as I was coming in, did some wounds, just made it a little bit tougher to get wounds back. How did you feel the balance was on that very first game there, Davey?
I think this one is in favor of the Stormcast. You know, Lord Celestine's got, he's set up for victory here, and that's fine. And you can bear that in mind if you're playing with somebody new. Obviously, give them the models that they're excited about. But if you got someone you pitch them the favorable side, I think that goes to the Lord Celestine. That being said, I did have a chance right at the end to, if the Khorgarath had come up big on his set of rolls, he could have pulled it off before going down, but not to be. And so our scenario played out just like the book. Lord Celestine came in, kicked some butt, and cleared LZ for the Stormcast to keep pushing on. And that brought us next to a Darkening Sky.
Now, this part of the story in the Gates of Azir, the prosecutors came barreling, out of their bubble from the Deep Strike, and we're careening through the air, kind of flying over top of things. And the Blood Reavers, there's a few of them that saw them and like, we got this. And they reached up and grabbed one of those prosecutors and dragged him down and tried to kill him. And then I think some other prosecutors came in and helped him out. But did they end up killing one of those prosecutors?
For this, it was almost a flawless victory for the Stormcast in the book. They managed to push through, get to the gate, and right as they were busting open the gate, finally is the time when they get brought down. But the Blood Reavers are all pumped. It's the Blood Reaver you got to see earlier, and you're like, oh man, this guy's gonna do some business, and they just basically come bouncing off. So if you want to play it yourself, it ends up being three prosecutors with a prosecutor prime, 20 Blood Reavers split into two units. You've got Chieftain, Icon Bear, and Hornblower, and really, your big decision as it goes is to decide which one of those goes into which unit, because they're split into the two tens. So what you get a chance for here is to learn which effects come with each, how flying works. You get some more charging and piling in because you got multiple units, and battle shot comes into play here. One slight difference here is you have Anactos as the prosecutor prime, and he gets an extra wound because he's a super cool prosecutor. And you're playing on Salong and Skinny Battlefield as the prosecutors try to sprint across. Gortide not only have to be 18 inches away from the prosecutors, but 18 inches away from each other, and it really doesn't provide a whole lot of flexibility as far as where you set up.
So, and this one again, the major victory is a little bit different for each one. For the Gortide, a major victory is if they take down the prosecutors. For the prosecutors, they just need to get across the field and into the exit zone, which is 6 inches from the backfield, basically, kind of signifying that they've made it to that gate that they were trying to get to. And it only needed to be one of the prosecutors in the hero phase. So it had to be at the beginning of their next turn. So let's look at the prosecutors. So the Blood Reavers first. What did the prosecutors have to go up against?
Blood Reavers are representing that sort of horde formation. Not super exciting until they get buffs, and those aren't really available here early on. They're only swinging one attack each, hitting on a four, wounding on a four. That's about as basic as it gets and still technically counting as a combat unit. There's a couple of units in the game that are maybe fives to hit, fives to wound, but those tend to be shooting units or swarms. We do get to reroll ones to hit because they're dual wielding in essence. And then the musician is making them charge and run faster. The icon bear is helping them out with their bravery. And the chieftain gets one more attack than the rest. They have an additional ability that doesn't come into play here. It happens later where they are more frenzied in the presence of a totem. That's where they really start stacking up. But we don't see it here. And that's fine because you're, like we talked about, you're learning how to use battle shock, more of the running and charging, more of the complex parts of that, and a little bit of shooting, which is where the prosecutors come in.
So the prosecutors also aren't a major combat unit for the Stormcast Eternals. They're movement 12. Obviously, they're flying, save 4 up, bravery 6, 2 wounds. So they've got a little bit over the Blood Reavers. They're hitting 4 up, 4 up. They've got 2 attacks each, but they've also got a ranged attack. So their range attack is the 4 up, 4 up, 18 inches. Their melee attack is 3 up, 3 up, and they've got 2 attacks each. But since the unit is 3 models, that's 6 attacks where you saw the Lord Celestin had that by himself. You know, these guys are trying to put that up. Herald of the Righteousness, they roll 3 dice instead of 2 in determining their charge move. And you declare a charge with this unit if it's within 18 inches. So obviously with 3 dice, it can reach that far. And then you can re-roll hit rolls of 1 for models from this unit. This was set up for us, so the prosecutors, I had the prosecutors, and I had 2 big units of Blood Reavers, and we didn't know exactly how they were going to go. And you set them up similar to what the layout was, you know, kind of that direct 18 inches and then the other 18 inches back, and I think you set them up in blobs. And so I had to figure out, okay, 18 inches away, so I had to, could choose to charge them, and or I could have flown over to some terrain and then, you know, maybe both of them, you know, get a plus to my save, while both of them probably would have had a chance to charge. And I ended up just charging them right in to that first unit of Blood Reavers. A little cocky, a little like, yeah, I got this. Just did a little shooting ahead of time, knocked off a couple of them. And really what happened is they did pretty well. I rolled pretty hot. And this is the first chance we got to see Battle Shock just decimate. How did that feel, Davey?
It was interesting because I didn't really know how Battle Shock worked. It was kind of a, let's do this, okay, now something called Battle Shock happened. And I got a couple swings, and I injured one, didn't take a model off. I said, okay, now Battle Shock, let's see. And I'd lost 5 or 6, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I guess I lose the entire unit unless I roll like a 1, you know, so... It was an interesting swing, an interesting thing about the models you got. Keeping in mind, because when you read through those war scrolls early on, you see, oh, this unit can be immune to battle shock. Is that a big deal? I don't know. So, yeah, they got wiped out, and then I'm like, oh, man, we got a problem here. But conversely, then I'm thinking, well, I could get lucky swinging back with the other unit and piling in, coming in. If I can force a battle shock on the Stormcast, then I can... That can really, you know, a bad battle shot can swing it. But I had positioned with the chieftain in the other unit, and I'd actually positioned, we were using terrain rolls as well. I set up near a piece of mystical terrain that was going to give me rerolls to wounds. So huge stack of attacks, rerolls to wounds, rerolling ones a hit. I was all set. And then I rolled that one befuddled, and I sat there for another round while the prosecutors then tried to slip around behind that unit, throw some hammers into him. They were getting into position to escape. I got one more charge off, and exactly like we talked about, managed to just do enough to cause the one wound and a bad battle shock, lost another prosecutor, and the prosecutors were down to just one guy. However, that one guy was enough to get the job done.
Yeah, so in my phase then, I was able to flee and got away pretty far managed to get over to the back. But then you still had, that was my round, but I had to last one more round. Managed to just, one prosecutor limping away. managed to hit that backfield and survive. You know, and I think against any other unit, the prosecutors are not quite that heavy hitting, you know, and taking out that first unit was super lucky. Had they gotten, obviously you can flee. Would you have set up, you know, having remembered, you know, two blobs and having played more games since, would you have changed how you set up that one to kind of trap or kind of keep them from getting back there?
There's not a whole lot of flexibility to do that. I would have shuffled some things around. I did have the musician up in the first unit because I didn't realize that it helped with runs and charges, and that first unit was likely to be the one getting charged rather than making one themselves. As far as positioning the formation, that's interesting. I don't know that there's a lot of flexibility there as far as that goes, but maybe spread that back one a little wider and bunch that first one up just to make sure that you get a pile and get to swing with as many as possible. But it was kind of the first idea of thinking about the impact that formations would have on how each of the phases played out. As far as it went, our scenario played out. Bloodbound did a little bit better than the book. We managed to drag most of the prosecutors down before they managed to get to the gate.
Because I wonder if you had positioned that first group like 18 and a half inches out from where I was at so that I wouldn't have been able to charge, and but I would have been able to fly out. But then maybe you would have gotten the charge the next time. I'm just wondering, you know, because it says set up at least 18 inches. But I'm wondering if that would have changed what I was able to do.
I don't know that I would have managed that with the prosecutors. They, with their high move and their charge, so they get to move in the move phase and then charge. So when you add those together, 18 inches is a whole lot closer than you realize. Given that they charge 3d6, so they're averaging 10 inches on the charge, add that to their move, and it's pretty hard to get away from far enough. Plus, they've got the shooting, so even if they don't manage to engage. However, yeah, it's not a bad idea. You could experiment with sliding both units back a little ways, making it a little more risky to get that charge, and giving the bloodbound player a chance to kind of pool up both units and bring that overwhelming force.
Nope, you're totally right. Forgot about the movement first. All right, so then the third scenario is called Indomitable. The armies consist of the Lord Relictor, so Ionis Kirborn, and a unit of three Retributors, which is the Large Hammer Swingers. And then the Gortide, which consists of five Blood Warriors and a unit of 20 Blood Reavers, so one unit with all 20. And in the book Gates of Azir, this is the point where when they deep strike or lightning strike in, the Retributors take up a line in front of the gate. And Ionis joins them, and his role there in the book is when one goes down, he heals them, and so that they can get up and fight again. So they're really forming this strong line, and then he's making sure that line's even stronger. And so let's talk about the units a little bit, the War Scrolls. We've already talked about the Blood Reavers, the 20 Blood Reavers. Let's look at the Blood Warriors.
Blood Warriors, interestingly, they've got a 4-up instead of nothing for a save, so that's a big bonus to them right there. They're also sporting two attacks. Those attacks are 3s to hit, 4s to wound. Their damage output is better than, you know, twice that of a Blood Reaver on a per-model basis. On top of that, if one of them gets killed, they get to attack again, and if they make a save, you get to make another roll, and on a 6, you get to inflict a mortal wound back on which is actually a pretty big deal, especially against Stormcast, who are sporting big armor. Again, this was a thing where playing it out, you kind of figured it out. We'll talk about that in a second, but we'll touch on the Stormcast real quick before we get into that, the details of the battle itself.
So the Retributors have two attacks, and they're 3-up, 3-up, minus 1 rend and 2 damage. So that's pretty great. But not only that, they have an ability called Blast to Ashes. And if the hit roll of an attack made by the model of the unit is a 6. So if instead of they got the 3-up, but if they hit a 6, the blast from its lightning hammer inflicts 2 mortal wounds instead of its normal damage. So instead of just 2 wounds, it's 2 mortal wounds. And so that means that no saves get to be had. They've got a 4 to move, so they're super slow. These guys are heavy armor, heavy hammers, so they're not moving very fast. The Lord Relictor, who's paired with them, also has four attacks, three to hit, three to wound, minus one rend, one damage. He's moving slow too. 4 inches movement, three up save, which is huge for any model to have a start with a three up, nine bravery and five wounds. He's got, he's not a wizard. He's a priest, and he has two abilities. With this, he's got a lightning storm and he's got a healing storm. The lightning storm, he picks any enemy unit within 12 inches and on a three or more, D3 mortal wounds, right? And we see this, we're going to see this a lot in a number of models when you're inflicting kind of a spell or anything like that. D3 mortal wounds is pretty common. The other side of that, though, to reflect his role in the book, is that if one of the retributors is damaged, is taken, he can use the healing storm, and on a roll of three up, he can heal D3 wounds that have been inflicted. The Gore-Tide must first set up 3 inches from one edge, all of them, and then the Relictor and the Retributor set up 3 inches from the other edge, kind of in the middle. What's interesting about this is it isn't just one wave. So this is trying to represent multiple waves hitting this space. And no matter how much damage they take, after three rounds, they set back up at full strength, back at the edge of the board, come again, and then a third time set up at full strength and come running down. Conversely, the Retributors do not get to reset. They've got the Ionis to heal them, but if he can't heal them, if they go out, they don't get to come back. So it's a wearing down. So it's definitely, I mean, one of the cool things about Age of Sigmar that we've talked about is that fun games, but not balanced. We're not trying, I mean, it's balanced in that the Retributors and Ionis Crypborn are hard to kill. And it takes, these three waves at full strength to try and do it. Davey, setting up all those models coming at my four models, what was your initial expectation, running down that battlefield?
For one, it looked pretty awesome and thematic, where you not only did I have 25 guys running at your four, but I was going to do it three times over. So essentially 75 guys were going to come run at these same four. That's pretty fun. Felt like it captured the book pretty well in that sense. For me, my instinct was, I'm going to throw all the chaff, the Blood Reavers, at them first, and that's easy to do because they are faster on their base move, 6 inches or 5 inches, and their musician makes them run and charge faster, so they're most likely to get there first. Now, in the first few waves, they arrive and, they don't hit very hard, and all of a sudden they're swarming around, and I found myself, I'm like, I actually can't get the Blood Warriors in because there's so many Blood Reavers crowding around. And it took me until the third wave to figure out that I really want to try and sneak the Blood Reavers in Blood Warriors in to the front. Not only because they hit harder just at base, but there are special rules. They have advantage to being hit. They either are killed and take extra swings, or they save and punch you back with their gore fist. So that was an interesting learning point as we went there.
So did you manage to take out one of the Retributors first round, or did that happen second round?
Yeah, I was 0 for on the first round. However, in the second round, got in. Not only did I kill one, on the first wave, I might have wounded one, and Crypborn attempted to heal, failed his prayer a couple times in a row. So by the time the second wave arrived, you still had an injured Retributor, and I was still focusing my attention on them because Crypborn seemed super hard to do anything to. So come piling in, kill two in one round, and then the battle shock actually knocked out the third. So you went into the third round with just Crypborn.
In the second round, I had moved up, which turned out to be a big mistake. The book sets you up in the back. You basically put your Lord Relictor against the back wall, and you put the Retributors all around him, so he can't get hit, right? And then by doing that, you basically form a half circle and a really, really small frontage. So that, you could probably get the Blood Warriors in there, or a couple of them. But if you've got the Blood Reavers up there, they're cramming up. And yeah, I went into, I think it was like the first round I took battle shock of so the second wave, first round, I think I lost all my Retributors, and I'm sitting there with Crypborn, naked as a newborn baby, waiting for the rest of your attacks to come crushing in. Luckily, that guy has staying power. Not only does he have his three up save, but in terrain, if he's sitting there, he's got a two up save, and then he's healing himself. So I was able to get more heals off. unfortunately, I couldn't do as many mortal wounds because I was just healing, like, you know, healing myself. But the Reavers were just bouncing off of them. There just wasn't anything there.
And we inadvertently hit on an interesting way to play the scenario, which is there's a tendency, and I've seen this game played by other folks. You can move the Stormcast to the back corner to make it the longest possible distance. But if you place a little bit of terrain towards the Blood Reavers, then that Stormcast player has the decision: do I move forward to take advantage of the terrain and get a little bit of extra armor save, but then, you know, put myself vulnerable to more attacks, or do I try and stretch out the duration of the engagement? So that was kind of a neat way of doing it. As it turned out, the very last round, I mathematically could have won. However, old Ionis Cryptborn was sitting on a 2-up save in cover and had healed himself up. I think he escaped the battle with a single wound, and that was fairly representative of the book. They managed to hold the line, and again, although the Stormcast won, just like in the book, I, in this case, did more damage than the book might have implied. I actually managed to drag some down, not quite as invincible as portrayed in the Gates of Azir. That brought us on to the Storm Breaks.
So the Storm Breaks is happens right after the gates in the Gates of Azir, when the prosecutors are able to open up the gates. And then through the gates, Sigmar is able to send more of the Storm Host in the way that's much easier than the lightning strike. This battle represents Ionis and the prosecutors getting relief, getting back up in the cave in the form of a unit of liberators coming in to help them. So it's the Lord Relictor, the three Retributors, same as the last game, but then a unit of five liberators. And they're up against the same five Blood Warriors, 20 Blood Reavers, but this time they're backed up by a Blood Secretor. And the Gortide set up first, 6 inches from the narrow edge of the battlefield. And the Lord Relictor and the Retributors set up wholly in the middle. And then the Liberators are going to lightning strike in. So they don't start up set up. And so they're going to be able to come in. The Relictor and the unit of Retributors, each unit, so there are two, that's two units, each suffer D3 mortal wounds to represent what's happened. The army with the most models within 6 inches of the center of the battlefield achieves a major victory. And if neither army has superiority, the side with the most models remaining achieves a minor victory. We've changed the scenario. We're not just trying to kill a bunch of models. It's the proximity to the middle. So if you get the Gortide there, I mean, they're all within 6 inches. So it seems like the impetus is on the prosecutors. Sorry, not the prosecutors, the retributors and the liberators and Ionis to dish out as much damage as possible to take them out, so that, because they'd be easy to hold that many models or more models within that proximity to the center.
The interesting shift here, you got the Blood Secretor has arrived. So he's a 4-inch move. Like most standard bearers, he's a pretty slow fella because he's got to bring around that great big heavy standard. He's a 3-up save, which is really beefy, especially for the Bloodbound. And he's 4 attacks, 3-ups, 3-ups, rend 1, damage 1. And then his Portal of Skulls, he can make sorcery harder, spellcasting that is, and it's irrelevant here. But crucially, if he plants that, then anyone within 18 inches with the Corn keyword is +1 attack. Also, he's a totem keyword, so Blood Reavers are going to be +1 attack just for being with him. So all of a sudden, they go from 1 attack a piece to 3 attack a piece. That gets really beefy. One thing that I managed to overlook in literally every game we've played with this model is he also makes Corn units immune to battle shock when he's around. So news to me. I was looking around and realized that. So that's a big, this is a real crucial model to bring into play. So we start to stack up some of the synergies and some of the things we might see here. I think one interesting variation, if you're trying to play this with somebody new and tying these scenarios together, you could play it as it stands with D3 mortal wounds to each of the Retributors or Ionis, or you could just play it with whoever actually survived the prior scenario, kind of up the ante a little bit with the game you just played.
So yeah, this is where, in like you said, this is where we start seeing really cool synergies. And in this box set, the Gortide have way more synergies in that respect than the Stormcast do. And it kind of makes them kind of start showing us what Age of Sigmar is supposed to be. And so the Blood Secretor, yeah, he's taken this unit, the Blood Reavers, that previously in the previous three games have not been impressive. They've been massive, and they've come in and they've just, you know, sometimes gotten in Davies way more than mine. But when you put the Blood Secretor next to them, they start corning up, you know, they upgrade, they power up, and they, you know, not, yeah, when you've got that many models, 20 models, and if you can get them surrounding that all within proximity, you're doing a ton of attacks, which means you're going to get some damage in.
So since we didn't actually play that one out, we can't compare our table results with the book results, but as the book went, the line was held. Stormcast were going at it with the Bloodbound.
I totally would have won that one. So it would have totally been in line with the book, so no worries there. We'll play it sometime in the future, and we'll make sure that that's the case.
So the fifth and sixth scenarios are fairly similar. We'll start with the fifth here, Reign of Death. This is full on. The Stormcast have their beachhead. They're coming in, and rather than being dismayed or taken aback, the Khorne Bloodbound are just excited to be full on. We have an actual battle for the first time in a long time. So you're looking at the Lord Celestin on Drakoth, Relictor, three Retributors, three Prosecutors, two units of five Liberators, and then the full Gortide Warband. And importantly, all of these units actually use the Thunderstrike Brotherhood and the Goreblade Warband, Battalion War Scroll. The only unit we've not seen at this point is the Mighty Lord of Khorne. That's coming in on the Bloodbound side. He is the general of the Gortide. He's got the Fleshhound riding with him. The Fleshhound is four attacks on a 3-up, 4-up. His Axe of Khorne is three attacks on a 3-up, 3-up, rend 1, damage D3, so that's hitting almost as hard as the Lord Celestin's hammer. But importantly, if he ever inflicts a wound on somebody and they survive at the end of that phase, they'll roll a dice on a 5 or more. He insta-killed, however many wounds remain. Very cool. He's got a command ability that can make Khorne warriors charge. If they're both mortal and Khorne, you can pick three units and they will charge on three dice rather than two, picking the highest two. So again, talking about stacking your abilities up.
The Liberators appeared in the last battle plan, but we forgot to talk about them. So I'll talk about them here. The Liberators are the core of the Stormcast army. They're the most iconic of them, and they're the most samey, right? It's that basic core archetype. And the Liberators appear a lot in all these books. They're the workhorse too. I mean, they're the basic unit, but they're certainly not Blood Reavers, right? They are. They have two attacks each, two wounds each. They movement 5, 4-up save. So they start with a 4-up, which is what a lot of heroes start with, and their bravery 6. Two attacks, like I said, 4-up to hit, and 3-up to wound. No rend, but they do damage 1. But they have two rules that just make them pretty great. The first is if they are attacking any model that has a wound characteristic of 5 or more, and that's all of the heroes, that's pretty much every single hero and every single monster, then they add 1 to all the hit rolls of the model. So now they're hitting on 3-up 3s. So 3-up, 3-up, which is what Corgus is hitting with his axe. So they're, that's not bad. And then with their shields, if they're equipped with their shields as they are in the starter set, you can reroll save rolls of 1 for the model of this unit. So they're 4-up. You put them into terrain, and they're 3-up, but they're rerolling 1s with their shields. So they're pretty strong. They're going to stick around if you play them right, and they're a really good shield wall coming up against something that's hitting hard to protect other units and such. And I think that's the way that they play best, is kind of that forming a shield around another unit so you can move them forward and take some damage on your Liberators and then, come in with your hero or something like that.
It's the same thing where, again, not a lot of synergies or interlocking abilities on the Stormcast, but if you can get that front line of Liberators in terrain with, they become a 3-up, rerolling 1s, they become very difficult to shift. And then you can apply your damage dealers, like your characters and your retributors, to the spot that you want. As far as this battle goes, the victory conditions are you're just looking to score that major victory right out of the rule book. You just play right out of the book. So you've kind of learned your rules all the way up to this particular battle, and now you're just playing it out. And so similarly, in Scenario 6 with Death Knell, you're still using full box set contents. It suggests adding anything else you may have. So if you've got collections or want to add something cool in, or somebody's picked up something extra, they can tuck those in. But that specifically is looking to get that final confrontation from the Gates of Azir, get that final confrontation between Corgus Cole and the Lord Celestin. And your victory conditions all hinge around whether one of those generals goes down. So it becomes a minor victory if you can kill the enemy general, and it becomes a major victory if you kill the enemy general with your general. So that's pretty fun, and it forces that push. It lets you take some risks of all right, well, you know, do I want to just satisfy myself with the minor, or am I going to put my own character at risk for the major? So there's a little back and forth there.
So with this one, we set up, you know, as the book says, that I did Thunderstrike Brotherhood. So I set a couple of units up on the table. I think I set the Lord Celestin up because I wanted to be able to use his command ability early on. And I wanted to be, you know, in case I got, I think because I had the lower number of units, I also got to choose a sudden death. And not, you know, I didn't want to say, oh, you know, let's pick something easy. I wanted to pick something a little bit harder. So I picked control a terrain piece, and I chose one that was way in the back. It's going to take something to get back there. And so it was at the end of the fourth round, I had to have a unit within 6 inches of that space. Now, I thought that'd be a fun one. Go back, try and control a piece of terrain after the fourth round. You know, certainly we're going to come after each other and do some killing. So I set up my Lord Celestin. I set up the Liberators, I believe, kind of off to one side, and I left everything else off the table. How did you set up, Davey?
Well, knowing, and for those actually looking at home, you'll notice that Scenario 5 says you actually should not use sudden death, but since we had never done that before, we were looking to practice it out, and, you know, it's new to us, so we'll figure it out. So try it out if you want. For me, the threat, and being new to it, I wasn't sure how fast things could move. I mean, you can read it on paper, but not really understand how fast things shift on the table. So I thought I'd try to swarm that objective that he needed to capture with my Blood Reavers, and then try to use the rest of the force to counter what he had on the table.
And you had spread out your kind of heavy hitter stuff further away from that. I think I'd picked it after you'd set up. So it was, your Blood Reavers were around to that piece of terrain, but your heavy hitters were further away from it. And so I tried to use my Lord Celestin to draw the heavy hitters out a little bit, but you really didn't fall for that right away. I think I got a few other things into another piece of terrain. I think I got Lord Relictor and my prosecutors into a hill or forest. And you didn't take the bait, you know, with Corgus. So I think I lightning striked another unit of Liberators over by him. The play by play, you know, every time I think the big one is your Corgus and your Stoker, I think, came into the forest after my prosecutor and Lord Relictor. I think we ended up battling out there for quite a bit. Remember my prosecutors lightning striking in, you kind of pulled a few things towards me. And so I was kind of like right between your front line and your back line. And I was right next to your blood secretor because he was had his standard planted. And my hope was, because I mean, it was just one guy, my hope was that you'd be like, your blood reavers would be like, oh, there's those tasty prosecutors, and they, from that previous battle, that you'd want revenge, and that your personal feelings about those prosecutors and how they'd just gotten past you and would just force you to kind of shove those blood reavers right up towards them. And Davey, what happened?
It actually kind of happened that way. And whether or not we were thinking the same thing, I thought I was going to be able to jump over there, wipe them out, and then somehow magically move back. And we had a little bit of the turns drop such that I didn't get the double turn, wasn't able to move back. And one prosecutor held on just long enough to tie me in. And I don't think I thought about the possibility of retreating. I was like, well, I'm going to kill this guy here and then I'll go do it. So that would have been something to consider. As it was, the prosecutors did their job, pulled the Blood Reavers off the objective, and Liberators dropped in. I did have the chance at the sweet Hail Mary. I managed to use the Bloodstoker's ability on Corgus Cole. And then he used his command ability on himself. So he's charging 3 dice, pick the highest 2, add 3. So he turbo moved across, did this huge charge back over to Liberators, but he couldn't solo wipe him out in the one turn. And so ended up landing in the Stormcast favor, just like the book. And actually, interesting, Corgus Cole survived to fight another day, again, just like the book.
And I think the way I positioned Vandas, he did jack all that whole game to wipe out anything. But everything was, for me, yeah, it was hinging on trying to just draw you out and use the lightning, you know, the lightning strike to pull back there. And I can't remember what it was. I mean, obviously we were playing, so there wasn't, I don't think there was a gotcha, because I was like, okay, I'm going to try and deep strike back there. But we just, you know, like you said, using Flea, being able to, you know, you're never stuck anywhere if you don't want to be, unless there's just things in your way, right? And so, you know, playing off of it was a really fun kind of to pick a scenario that wasn't just kill everything, right? It took we wanted to kill things, we wanted to stop things, but it did change the way we were playing some things. But like even in Warhammer 8th, it's sometimes hard to just play the objective and not, you know, kind of have certain units do what they want to do.
Crucially for me with the sudden death rule, it meant not only was it playing the objective, it was playing two objectives for me. You know, I had two loss conditions, which, and I think interesting here, and we'll look at for your overall thoughts at the box set, what you picked up from it. For me, the big thing I picked up, I feel like the Bloodbound side, they almost have a higher skill cap where, because they have so many overlapping synergies, if you can take full advantage of them, they become extremely powerful. Literally, I mean, we talked about earlier, I totally forgot that the Bloodscrater could make people immune to battle shock. I never once used the battalion abilities of if somebody succeeds in a charge, somebody else gets to reroll charges, or if a unit on any side is wiped out, plus one attacks. There are all these abilities that I wasn't able to use, but crucially in this last scenario, because my force got split, it was hard to stack up those abilities on each other and take full advantage of that. So that is a thing to keep in mind. If you're playing against that Bloodbound force, you can find out a way to split them up. They maybe can't stack themselves up. On the other hand, the Stormcast are a lot more self-sufficient, so they can survive and thrive in that isolated, heroic, last stand, not actually a last stand sort of scenario. What did you pick up from actual gameplay here?
Yeah, I mean, once we were able to get all the models on the table, it certainly, it was a really fun game, and it was really cool to take and try and figure out how you're grouping units. Because like you said, even though the Stormcast don't have as many synergies, you're still trying to pay attention to what your kind of like teams are, right? So obviously the starter sets, the scenarios told me that the Lord Relictor and the Retributors should probably stick together. They were a really good team, and they, you know, played well together against your, you know, Korgorath and Vec again, you know. You know, the Retributors played that kind of shield wall role, but then they also, I knew that deep striking them into the back, even if they got attacked or charged, they were probably going to stick around long enough to be, you know, stay within 6 inches of that terrain. And so they're just that durability. And so you learn a couple of things about the characteristics of those units. But the scenario and the terrain and, you know, what you're playing against can change up what those kind of pairings might be. And just like you said, though, that it was easier for me to create kind of these units because they, you know, their abilities stood alone. And, you know, yeah, with yours, not only, you know, some of your units were, or your abilities were kind of like area of effect, right? When that icon came slamming down, everything within a distance, but some things you had to choose. And so, you know, Corgus chose himself to, you know, put some capabilities on, which made him a single, even more brutal force. Or you stack some of those things onto the Blood Reavers and they become just this massive, you know, wave that you can crash down on somebody. So there's a lot of versatility, but yeah, you can't split up your force too much. Otherwise, you know, you have both choices and, you know, distance to try and figure out.
So overall, we'd say fun, great for getting somebody in. You got the iconic forces of Age of Sigmar, and you can build up your way. The only last comments I'd say is you can salt in as much additional complexity as you want as far as what terrain rules you want to use. The important thing, even if you got somebody new, is make sure, you know, you can, just because you have terrain on the table doesn't mean you have to go whole hog and use all the rules. If you got someone new who's already challenging to figure out the rules of the force, maybe don't distract yourselves with the extra terrain rules. Just have it look cool, and you can play even that first scenario. If you got a little cool building around, makes it interesting. Might have something to run around. So, recommended in general as two players who've played a fair amount of 8th, and then especially for someone who's learning or teaching the game.
And I'd say it's worth playing these through, but I don't think they're super replayable. It's great for introducing. There are so many more battle plans and scenarios, and you know, none of these had any times of war you know, area, you know, scenery, or you know, we're in Akshi, but there's no, you know, geysers and flaming anything. So you'll get more of that as you get into other things. Again, though, pare the rules down as you need to make sure that you know what's going on and you don't feel like you're overwhelmed by it. And your own, you know, whether you're Stormcast or your Chaos, you know, get to know your rules and have fun with them.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a long haul. We had a whole lot of fun. I hope you did too. Thanks for sticking with us. And we'll catch you on the next episode. Let us know what you think.
Well, our time has expired, and it's time for our reforging. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Mortal Realms podcast. If you know someone who's curious about Age of Sigmar, tell them about this podcast. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, Mal is at Mortal Realms, Davey is at Red_Zeke, and Eric is at Stone Monk Gamer.
For Sigmar!
For Sigmar!
Blood for the Blood God.
Yeah, we may have spent quite a while on that. That's we'll see. We'll get Wes for feedback.
Hopefully, it'll be better in post.